right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are. It's the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin, once again, alongside Dom. Dom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am excellent. We have something very exciting in store today. We are joined once again with by a cast member of Survivor Ghost Island. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun getting to hear the full inside scoop today from James Lim. James, how are you doing?
Doing great. Good. Thanks for having me, guys. And I'm looking forward to this podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much for being here. I know you just got home from a pretty exciting trip abroad. You want to talk a little about what you've been up to just since the finale?
So about a week after the finale, first of all, subled my own apartment to a friend of mine at work. So I am currently technically homeless, and I used all my airline miles and hotel points to book a month-long Euro trip. Ranging from London to France, Italy, Greece, and on the way home, a little bit in Doha, Qatar. It was 31 days, 6 countries, 20,000 miles, my own little amazing race, because I seem to have missed out on the Amazing Race 31 cast. So that was amazing, and now I'm back at home on my second part of the summer, which is the American tour. And so I've been in Boston, New York City, Philadelphia right now with a friend from high school. I'll be in D.C. soon to see Brendan, Orlando for Give Kids a World, etc., and just traveling until the summer's over.
And do you know what your plans are when all of this settles down a bit, or are you trying to keep that adventure going for as long as possible?
This will go on for about another month. I'm currently juggling some options, but at this point, it looks like I'll be moving back to Boston this fall for grad school.
Oh, awesome. So is that an MBA? Is that at the Kennedy School? Or what do you have in mind there?
It's funny you just assume Harvard when I say Boston. But yeah, so it'll be a JD MBA dual degree between Harvard Law and Harvard Business.
Okay. I know there are like 25 different universities in Boston, but Harvard seemed like a pretty safe one to guess that.
So, James, just full disclosure, Dom is an Oxford grad who harshly judges Harvard and all Harvard alums.
Not true.
I've been to Boston with Dom. You should have seen the enthusiasm when I dropped him off at the Harvard Library to go, like, judge the hell out of that place.
I will say, I have been to Oxford, and our libraries are nothing compared to Oxford's library.
Don't admit that. Like, don't ever cave to this guy.
Well, I mean, game respects game, you know? Like, we think we're old, we're like 400 years old. Oxford's like 1,000 years old, so, you know, they got to have some things to brag about.
We do have you beat on the library front, and everywhere else, to be fair, but I'm curious what you made of Oxford as a whole when you visited, because as someone who has kind of done that visit in the opposite direction, I'm curious what you made of it yourself.
Yeah, so I was there as part of my Euro trip. I have a couple of friends from school who are getting their master's there, and one Rhodes Scholar who's currently at Oxford, and they gave me a nice little campus tour. What I loved is like the architecture, the actual town of Oxford. I feel like I love Cambridge and Harvard Square, but I love the town, the campus. That actually has its beat. The library was gorgeous, the history. And as a Harry Potter fan, you can't, beat having the Great Hall as your own dining hall. And so I got to walk around.
That's
that.
That's not bad, yeah.
No, not at all. I will say, though, you guys seem to have a very, like, separated college structure. So if you're in Trinity College versus Jesus College, or Jesus College, it's not Spanish, I guess, you guys don't interact much. Whereas for us, our 12 residential colleges interact every day in classes. So that was interesting. I do feel like we have a better sports system. Intense one, which I, was a part of, and I loved it. So that, I think I like that on the American side. But overall, like to hear about my friends love it because they got to do 4 years in the States in college, and now they're in, like the premier British institution, getting their master's, and they're loving the new aspects of like the culture, the actual campus, the educational system that you guys have. So big fan.
Yeah, we don't really have college sports or any college pride in general. If you see someone wearing an Oxford hoodie, it's a 90% chance it's a Spanish tourist who's just picked it up as a souvenir. So you don't really get that. But the thing that struck me visiting Harvard and then Boston in general was obviously Cambridge and Oxford as towns maybe a little comparable. But you have the greater Boston area just right there that you can visit and enjoy, whereas we're just isolated in our own little bubble, kind of stuck away from everywhere else.
Yeah, no, I took that train for an hour outside of London, but it wasn't too far away, And yeah, I confirmed with them that like the Oxford Cambridge, you know, spirit isn't really there compared to like, you know, even Harvard Yale or like any big rivalry in the States, which was shocking to me.
Yeah. James, outside of this Euro trip, long before that, I know you've been someone who's been all over just the globe growing up. Tell us a little bit just about your background from that perspective.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm the kind of guy that when people ask me, okay, where are you from? It's a pretty long story, like, because I don't feel like I have one place that I'm from. I've been a nomad my whole life. So I was born in L.A., and I'm really proud of that. You know, have my, like, birth certificate from the county of Los Angeles and all that. My father went to UCLA, got his PhD there. So I was born there, and at the age of two, my entire family, at that point in time, me, my mom, and my dad moved back to Seoul, South Korea. Both my parents are South Korean citizens, and they still are. I'm the only American in the family. So we moved back to Seoul, Korea. I grew up there just like a typical South Korean, you know, like kid. But I knew that I was at that point in time, a dual citizen, and I always knew that I was born in the States, you know, and for me, that almost felt like there was a reason why I was born there. It was somehow, like, somewhat meant to be.
Because you're going to be president someday, obviously?
I don't know. I guess I am also a reality TV personality, which, you know, is the current president's qualification. So.
You may need to up the controversy factor a little bit.
True, yeah. But if there's a Survivor ticket, you know, I would love to help out with the campaign and stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, you and Yule 2028. I'm down for that. I'm sure lots of other people would be too.
Hey, a man can dream, you know. And so I did grow up, you know, just alongside my friends in Seoul. And fun fact is that, you know, some people actually still don't know the city of Seoul, but everybody now knows the district of Gangnam because of Gangnam Style, the hit song. And that's one district within Seoul, and it's like the center of, you know, shopping, entertainment, education, like pretty much everything. And I grew up there for, I think, 13 years, only in that district. And the thing is, I did have the conscious knowledge that I was a dual citizen. You know, I was born on U.S. soil, so I was American. I was born to Korean parents, thus I was Korean. At the age of, I believe, 12, I made a choice to become only American. So rescinded my Korean citizenship, became fully American. Once I made that choice, I knew that I was you know, slated to return to the States at some point in time. We all knew that the earlier I made that transition back to the States to return, the better for my life. And so instead of thinking about college, we decided to try the boarding school route. Without a home in the States, it would have been possible for me to go to a public high school. So I applied to some boarding schools in the States and decided to matriculate to Phillips Andover near Boston. When I was 16, I came back to start in Andover as a new sophomore alone. And since then, it's been, you know, 3 years there, 4 years at Harvard, 2 years in New York City. And now I guess I'll be moving back to Harvard for grad school. But that's been my life. And this is kind of like one of the big themes I want to touch on, because one of the things that I loved about your podcast with Dominic, it was one of my all-time favorites from Survivor, is that it goes into Dom as not only a Survivor player, but also Dom as a man and a husband and a father. And I loved learning more about the guy that I, you know, freaking love, Dom Abati, as a person. And for me, one of the biggest things I think defines me as a person is that background, the fact that I am a first-generation American who, you know, actively chose to be an American and to come back to the States and to live my life here as a proud American. And that was a big part of, you know, my confessionals on the show and all that as well. So, you know, that's kind of like my background. And so,
well, quickly, just on that, yeah. If you don't, with kind of along those lines, if you don't mind getting into it, what prompted you to rescind your Korean citizenship and decide, okay, I definitely want to be in America full time?
Yeah, it's a little bit hazy, but I believe what happened was there was a new law that required a choice or something like that. But basically, I had to choose. And so for me, it was a matter of which country do I see my future in? And this might sound like a little bit like outlandish, but I, you know, even back then I really felt in tune with that, you know, like cheesy concept of like the American dream and paving my own future path in the States, where, you know, I knew that there were all these amazing opportunities for me. And we had taken multiple trips back to the States as a family for my parents to show me what, you know, I could experience back in the States. And so it was almost like idealistic, this vision that I had of the States, which prompted me to choose to become an American citizen. And I have to say that it's been, you know, what, like 13 plus years since that day that I chose. And I don't think I've regretted that decision one second. And, you know, I truly like love being an American citizen. And like, I'm the kind of guy that, you know, if there's ever like the anthem playing, like I'll always, you know, like feel this, like, you know, like gut feeling inside. It does mean a lot to me. So yeah.
What was your family's reaction to that choice? Were they mostly supportive, or because I imagine that's the kind of thing which that's a major turning point in your life. If you make this one choice versus the other, that's going to determine your future path, and I imagine are going to force them to make some further choices themselves. So what was that for you and your family as a whole?
Yeah, so what's remarkable is that, and I give them a lot of credit for this, even when I was that young, they ultimately, if I remember correctly, left the final choice up to me. And so they told me, okay, you make your choice and you tell us why, and then we'll react. And so they, you know, did allow me as this young boy to have the final say. And once I told them why and where, they were like, okay, you've made your choice, and now, you know, we're going to do everything we can to support that transition. And so the fact of the matter is, you know, since my entire family is about 8,000 miles away from me, you know, I don't see them in person more than once a year if I'm lucky. We do Skype pretty often, but, you know, it has been a reality that makes me different from most of my peers here in the States. But at the same time, you know, it hasn't affected my love for them at all and their love for me. And, you know, the one thing is that my sister, she's 18 now, and I do wish that I had a lot more time being beside her as an older brother growing up. But you know, the hope is that down the road, we'll have time to make up for that gap. But yeah, no, it's a pretty unique situation. But at the same time, I think, you know, I wouldn't change a thing. And it's been an amazing journey for me personally ever since that day.
What was your family's reaction when you told them you were going to go on reality TV? Because I imagine that's kind of a curveball when most of what they're hearing is, oh, I'm going to Harvard, and oh, I'm the captain of the Harvard track team, and now it's, I'm going to go starve on an island for a month and potentially make a fool out of myself.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, if you ask a South Korean adult about Survivor, the first reaction always is, oh, that's the show that Yul Kwon won. So Yul Kwon won.
That's anytime anyone asks me about it. That's what I say.
Yeah. So Yul Kwon won Cook Islands in about 2006, if I remember correctly. And what happened then was it was front page news in South Korea because of the fact that a Korean American had won this, you know, gigantic, phenomenal TV show in the States that encompasses like social skills, survival skills, physical skills. And he also broke so many stereotypes that really haunted Asian Americans on TV to that day. And so just, you know, because of the fact that he was Korean American, it became headline news in Korea. So I read about it on the papers myself. My parents heard about it. And so that's what they remembered. Now, what's funny is that they never fully grasped how big of a deal this was until my dad literally came to the finale. And, you know, there was like TMZ, like paparazzi there, like waiting for us outside the club. Like that's when he first realized how big of a deal Survivor actually still is in the States. But yeah, I told them that I was contacted for casting. Their reaction was, yeah, like that's fun, but you're not going to make it. Like the odds are so small. And then I actually made it. Then they were like, okay, holy shit, you're going to go die. Like, isn't that the show that people go just die? And I'm like, no, like the French version, yes, there have been incidents, but I don't think I'm going to die. There's a really good medical team, so I have to reassure them, you know. And at the end of the day, they also have, you know, to give them more credit, like I was 24 at that point in time. And so I was at an age where I'm going to make my own life decisions. And so for them, it was ultimately, look, like if you want to do this, go on this crazy adventure, and if you think it'll help you become like a better person and, you know, learn more about yourself, go do it. And I wasn't going to let that opportunity go at all. Like I was ready to, if push came to shove, quit my job for Survivor, which I didn't have to. But so, yeah, they supported me all the way. My loved one's choice was supposed to be my father if I had made it. And so they were supposed to fly my father from Seoul, Korea, directly to Fiji, instead of having him come to L.A. and then all the way back across the Pacific to Fiji. And I believe he would have become the second foreigner ever to be a loved one after Abby Maria's mom, who's Brazilian. And I personally believe that, you know, if I had made that episode, it would have been such a powerful moment, because, you know, it's clearly obvious that, you know, like, James's father is a Korean citizen coming from Korea, and James is an American, and it would have underlined my personal journey as a first-generation American more, but, you know, we all know what happened, so maybe one day, you know?
Well, the great Vera Gomez is a hard example to live up to, but with what you said about Yul, you do hear from time to time about the impact that his win had on Asian Americans in the United States, but it's interesting to hear just how that win was received in Korea as well. I imagine it's a totally different kind of framework for looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, within South Korea, the framework was more around, you know, ethnic pride and this renewed interest in a genre called reality TV, which at that point in time in South Korea was not really a thing. And to be honest, I think it's still not really a big phenomenon in South Korea.
I disagree, my friend. I think they got the reality TV game figured out.
Are you talking about The Genius?
I sure am.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that show. And a lot of people have recommended that I watch it because I speak Korean, so I can understand everything. But I don't know. Maybe one day if I have a lot of time. Maybe this summer. But
You'll probably hear a lot more about it over the course of the next 2 hours or so. But hopefully we can keep Colin on his leash there. But I know you've said a lot in your interviews that one of your you were mostly happy with the way CBS handled your edit and your experience there. But one of your regrets in that regard is that they didn't do more to highlight your background and what that meant for you as someone going out there. So can you touch on that a little bit more?
Yeah. Yeah, to reiterate, I do feel that I got a very, you know, like, accurate edit that portrayed me as who I actually am. It showed both my highlights and my lowlights in a fair light. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, it is rare for somebody to escape a Survivor season with you know, like, his professional image intact and his career intact. So I'm grateful for that. And nobody gets a perfect edit on Survivor. So with all that being said, if I were to design my perfect edit, it would have probably had more elements of my unique journey to that point. And so what, you know, being a first generation American means to me. And so we touched on that a little bit in my boot episode when I went into about how, you know, at the age of 16, I had to come back from a foreign country to return to the States and adjust to a school with, you know, no friends, a new language, a new culture. And that experience gave me the skills necessary to adapt to these vastly different situations and circumstances. And that kind of skill was what I believed would propel me through this tough swap onto the merge. And that didn't end up happening, but I got to tell the audience some bit of that journey. But it's also, you know, just simple things like about, I think it was Brendan who told me, post-game that, you know, how people do these word associations with Gordon in their ex-interviews, and he ended up choosing a different word, but for me, he almost said refreshingly patriotic for his phrase for me, because despite the fact that I grew up abroad, he believed that I seemed more patriotic even than most of the castaways on that season. And we would talk about those topics sometimes chilling on the shelter, and so I think my cast does know, like, what that history means to me and what America means to me. But just, yeah, like, the opportunity to tell a little bit more about what I've been through and what just this country means to me. Because I do believe that in this day and age especially, a chance for somebody to go beyond political tribal lines to just say, okay, like, I'm a guy that just loves America as a country and I love what this country stands for, would have been a, you know, a powerful message to send to the audience of Survivor. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still very happy about who I was on TV, and I feel like I was able to be who I truly am on the island and be shown that way and to escape this season pretty unscathed. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I'm sure Brendan meant that with the best of intentions, but it's an odd way to frame it, because in your case, you had to make this difficult choice about where you wanted to be in the world, and you chose the United States. Whereas a lot of people who maybe have that ingrained patriotism in the U.S., they never had to make that choice. It's just that they get to enjoy that without having anybody question it or without having to make those difficult decisions.
Yeah, exactly. There was actually a New York Times feature that I read way back several years ago that looked at, I believe, people in my shoes who either through immigration or like me, like returning to the States, like made the active decision to be American. And the theory is that psychologically, that act of deliberately deciding to be American makes people more committed to the concept of America than people who are just born American and stayed American. And so I do feel like that deliberate choice for me was probably the single most important day in my life, the day that I actually decided to live my future life as an American and to return to the States.
Did you, as you were going through casting, say to yourself, okay, I'm probably up for the one spot that's going to go to an Asian guy this season, unless they decide to bring the race wars twist back for whatever reason? And how much did you feel any kind of extra pressure, if at all, being probably the only representative of that community? Because to reference Yule again, I know that was something that was heavily on his mind during his season.
Yeah, I mean, having seen enough seasons, I knew that I was going to be probably, yeah, the lone representative of, you know, Asian Americans on the season. And that was obviously me as soon as we got to pregame Ponderosa. But so while I was conscious of the fact, I don't think it really tangibly affected my decision making or my gameplay. And the fact of the matter is, I'm the kind of person who always went into Survivor thinking, I'm going to present the best version of myself. I'm going to be genuine. I'm going to play hard. I'm always going to be like sincere to other castaways. And that decision wasn't because, oh, I was like repping all the Asian Americans here, but it was more like, I want to play the game the way I want to. And for me, I wanted to be who I really am in the real world. And so it was more a byproduct of that thought process. But yes, I was conscious of the fact that I was representing a pretty big group. It's not even that, like, in my mind, you know, I was representative of Asian Americans, of first generation Americans, of the track and field community, of Harvard, of my prep school. Like, you know, the fact that it wasn't going to be part of my, you know, fake identity, but I wanted to show people that, you know, Harvard guy, they don't really all have to be douchebags. Like, they're not. Like, we're not. And on the way home, a producer told me that, you know, I proved to her that not all Harvard guys are stuck-up assholes. And I was like, good, because we're not, you know? Like, thank God
Fired
I was
Zeke.
Able to... Oh, no, I believe that Zeke is one of the best passing courses to have come from Harvard. But, yeah, so while I was fully aware of that reality, and I knew that I was going to be, you know, received as, okay, so let's see how the Asian of the season does, I don't think it really, you know, hampered my game in any way.
Yeah, you Harvard guys have a pretty good track record on Survivor, so I'm not sure in that respect you have much to worry about. But returning to Yule quickly, when he won his season, I think lots of people enjoyed both the fact that he won and the ending to that season, which was built up as this clash of the titans, where you have Yule versus Ozzy, you have the incredibly smart strategic player versus the dominant challenge competitor. But that's also an unfortunate way to frame it, because it almost implies that that's all they really are. Like, Yule is only this, and Yule's no slouch physically, obviously. Just you can just look at the guy, but that's almost what his play style and his character was reduced to, and likewise for Ozzy in the other direction. So it's you come away from that with a rather kind of one-dimensional understanding of Yule just as a guy, even if the way they did that was maybe necessary to make the season ending as exciting as it was.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't interacted with Ozzy myself, but I did have a phone call with Yule after coming back from Survivor, because one of my former roommates works at Facebook, and they have an internal database where you can reach out to other employees. And he reached out to Yule telling him that, you know, his really good friend was on Survivor. So we got to chat, and Yeah, I do believe that it sounded like he still has a really fond memory looking back at Survivor. And he, you know, like, seems open to going back if his busy work schedule allows for it. But the problem is, you know, I think he's saving Facebook basically right now, so it may be a little bit tough. But, you know, the sense that I got from him was that if you were to – I mean, I get your point, but – in terms of, like, let's say marketing, right? Like, it's easy to build somebody up as this symbol of a certain trait. And so, for instance, Wendell and Dom, was Wendell an aggressive player at some points in time? Yes. Was Dom socially adept at some points in time? Yes. But it's easy for us to build a season as the clash of the Titans 2.0 with the aggressive, electric Dom Abati versus the laid-back social mastermind Wendell Holland. While we all know that they are not just that caricature, they're like really complex players with different skill sets. It's, I think, a reality of having to market a TV show to the audience. You build it up as the physical god, Ozzy, versus the strategic god, Yul. But yeah, I mean, let's face it, that guy is shredded as well. So he's no slouch.
Yeah, you're just on every single basis is just crushing life, it seems. But you saw him in the early part of that season. He was getting frustrated with one of his tribe mates in Cowboy for just like constantly joking about and perpetuating these stereotypes. And he was conscious of how that would come across on TV. And I think for Yul, would you say that it was easy for the audience at large to accept his win because he fit into their model of what an Asian American winner would be like, where he's quite quiet and soft-spoken, quite corporate, but just very smart, very competent, and it's easy for them to fit that into their existing model, if you like.
That's a very interesting point, actually. Well, I think they got lucky in that sense then, because if, let's assume that hypothetically, if, you know, on the flip side, Ozzy was a strategic mastermind, and if Yul won like 5 or 6 individual immunities, how would that have been received by the American audience? That's interesting. But I think at the end of the day, Yul and Ozzy both did, you know, play up what was stereotypically expected of them, which is a fortunate coincidence. And so did it make the acceptance of Yul's win easier? Maybe. But at the same time, you know, if you even ask himself, like Yul himself admitted, yeah, like, I focus on the strategy, the analysis, and because that's who he was, right? As a person, we're both. I love the fact that you called us like the victims of the management consultant syndrome, and I totally agree with that.
I forgot Yul about was, that.
Yeah, Yul was a white-collar business professional going to Survivor, and so was I. And so we spoke very much in a similar manner throughout the season. And so it's, you know, interesting to have the first Asian American winner be that guy who was very, you know, brilliant, very well-spoken, very calm. And while it may have fed into what people expect from an Asian winner, at the end of the day, I think it was a positive note altogether. And yes, you know, Yul did prove that, well, like, look at this guy. You know, he's shredded. He has charisma. He's a leader. He's a natural leader. And so while doing all of that, he also broke stereotypes for our community. And so he really was a Superman that season, I have to say.
I guess a larger question there, too, is when you have the label Asian American, that's a very broad umbrella, and it's often used to lump in a lot of very different life experiences as if they're similar or you can categorize in the same way. And so I imagine Yul's win and the reception to that as a Korean American would be very different from some other people's experiences, which don't really align with that, but which people would want to classify in the same way, maybe.
That's definitely true. I think, and that's a phenomenon more broadly just in our society today, even, that people think that Asian American, like that phrase, can accurately capture the essence of a very diverse subpopulation. And the fact of the matter is, you know, Asian Americans here today, right now, come from a wide variety of not just races and, you know, ancestral backgrounds, but also, you know, socioeconomic classes, about their geographic, you know, like there are Asian Americans in the South, in the Northeast, in the West. Even, you know, Natalie Anderson is Sri Lankan American, and she is technically the second Asian American winner ever, but people don't think that way because she doesn't look East Asian, you know? And so at the end of the day, I feel like the idealist in me hopes that someday we will get to be portrayed for that diverse group of people that we are to tell our stories. But, you know, we are making small steps. And I don't know, like, if I can help bring some more momentum into that process, however I can, like, I'd love to, you know.
Well, if you had hypothetically won, would that have been as big a deal in 2018? Would that be front page news in South Korea? Or was that more a sign of it being 2006 and there still being a front page to the news to be read rather than just seeing stuff on Twitter?
I don't know. I think it still would have been a big deal because the South Korean media does keep a keen eye on what Korean Americans are doing and all their, you know, achievements in the States, because in South Korea, since it's such a homogenous country, they still feel this concept of ethnic pride. And so, like, whatever I do, they will be like, yeah, like, that guy, you know, he even, like, grew up in Seoul for a bit. He's Korean American. And so we get to be happy for his accomplishments. And yeah, I mean, I would have loved to win. It would have been a pretty fun experience, or, like, even just a gratifying experience getting to tell my story in a much deeper, you know, like, a much greater depth, and to, you know, receive more exposure postseason. But I still believe that for all that's happened to me, it was, for my survivor journey, it has been nothing but life-changing and incredible. And, you know, I love to go back and play again, so.
Yeah. All right.
How much hope do you think there is for anybody to get that well-rounded portrayal nowadays? Because you gave the example of Dom and Wendell, both of whom were very big characters on the season and got a lot of screen time, and yet still, I think, were reduced in some part to these one or two characteristics. So, as you said, Wendell was the more laid-back social player, Dom was the more aggressive strategic player, but in reality, it's a more complex picture for both of them. And then you have on the sidelines people like Chelsea who got nothing at all, and there's really no portrayal there, well-rounded or otherwise. So in the modern era of reality TV and, I guess, Survivor editing, is that something that we can hope for, or is this just a pipe dream, do you think?
That's a good question. I think I'd love to be a fly on the wall when production does post editing, and when they decide, you know, like, which confessionals to air and who to build up as the big characters of the season. But I think the truth is, with a 20-person season in place and with 43 minutes or something of airtime per week, it really, I think they've maybe figured out that the optimal strategy to make Survivor an enticing, appealing show week by week is to maybe, you know, pick a few people, make them superstars, pick a few people and give them, you know, like, reasonable edits, like, nothing too great, but definitely, like, let them know, let them be known as for who they are, like my edit, for instance, and have some unfortunate people who get purpled out, like Chelsea. And she, you know, I didn't play with her, but for all I know, she definitely deserved way more. And she was a much more strategic player than what was shown to be. But I think that's the current reality of TV. You know, we have other shows like Big Brother or RuPaul's Drag Race, I've heard, that go for that, you know, like, that factor. You know, like, they want people to remember that shocking scene or the shocking soundbite or this hugely controversial character. To compete with those shows, the reality is Survivor also has to adapt by building up, you know, Dom, the next Tony Vlaco, or Donathan, the lovable gay guy from Kentucky. It's how they, you know, survive as a show, Survivor.
Yeah. Let's get into how this all started to come to be a reality for you here, where I know you initially started as applying for The Amazing Race. What was your background as a just Survivor, Amazing Race, potential? I don't know if you've ever dabbled in Big Brother or not, but before you started, like, binge watching, once you knew you were going to be a part of the show, How familiar were you with it and things of this nature before it was about to become a thing that was going to be a real part of your life?
Yeah, so my story starts in around fall 2012. It was my first semester in college, and on campus we got the service called Philo. I think it was through like Harvard IT or something, and you get to log on to watch television on your laptop. So it was one Sunday, and, like, this sounds crazy, but it's true. I was just in the library after finishing my homework, and I was just chilling on Philo, And on CBS, it was a show called The Amazing Race. And literally my thought process was, I love racing. I'm a sprinter. Let's check out The Amazing Race. So I tuned in and I watched an episode and I was hooked. And I mean, like, everything, like the strategy, the traveling, Phil, like the team dynamics. So I got really into The Amazing Race just based on that one episode. And I became a hardcore fan, watched every single episode for the next 4 years. And I'm talking like, I would like, you know, you could probably ask me about like each leg or who won which season, that kind of stuff. And then around senior winter, so 2016, around January, the track team, we returned to campus early and have like a 3 week long team training camp to prepare for the indoor season. And then your daily schedule is basically, you know, practice 2-3 hours a day, then just bond as a team the rest of the day. We have a lot of free time to just have fun. And so I turned to one of my best friends from Harvard, David Gallas. Big shout out to him. He was also a sprinter like me, my class at Harvard. And I told him, dude, like, so I have an idea, right? So we're both employed. We have jobs now lined up. We have one final summer between commencement and the start of our jobs. Let's apply for the Amazing Race and go racing around the world for that summer. And so I really pitched it to him. And to give him credit, he was like, you know, hell yeah, why not? So we shot this application video. It was really just cheesy stuff. Like, looking back, it wasn't good at all. But we shot a video selling hard this idea of, you have two Harvard sprinter bros that, you know, win races for a living. And so we are going to just come on your show and we're going to crush it. We're going to win every leg. We got this, right? At the same time, we are quite different, despite being best friends, that I didn't have a license back then. He didn't have a passport, I believe. I'd never driven in my life up to that point. So we pitched that, you know, dynamic duo, and they actually liked it. And so we got a call back from CBS casting the next day. And then we were like, this might actually happen. So we went through a casting process. In the middle of that process, they told us that season 29, which was the one that we applied for, was going to be a single player season for the first time ever. And you guys, if you follow the show, you'll remember that 22 individuals started the game, and there was a schoolyard pick at the end of leg one in LA. So David dropped out, and I kept going through the process, and I got cut, I want to say, pretty far, but I didn't make it to the finals week in LA. And so, you know, they told me that they had found more, you know, bigger personalities that season. I was totally fine with it. I had just had so much fun, you know, getting calls from CBS and making better videos and stuff. So, you know, I let it go. And I forgot about it, graduated, started my job in New York City. And then November 2016, I got that initial email from SEG saying, hey, so we found your bio from back when you applied for The Amazing Race, and we think you'd be great on Survivor. And then my reaction is, they asked me two questions. The first question was, have you heard of it? And the second question was, do you want to apply? And the answer to both, you know, was, hell yeah, right? It was more like, F yeah, but, you know. So
you can swear if you want to. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if that's your thing.
Let it all out, James. Go
So at that point in time, I had never seen a single episode of Survivor, truth be told. And technically, this makes me a recruit. I'm proud to be a recruit from The Amazing Race.
All right, hang up the call. Get out of here. We need to get this guy off the podcast.
I know, right?
Just filthy casuals.
So, oh, and I have a point to make about that down the road. But yeah, so they recommended that I watch 33, which was live back then. So I tuned in, watched the premiere. I loved it. And I'm saying the same feeling that I felt for The Amazing Race 4 years back. I love the characters, and I did choose, they happened to, you know, choose a pretty good season for me to start with. A season with fun characters, just good people, good gameplay. And so I got hooked on Survivor. And this time it was more like them telling me, you have a legitimate foot in the door. You might be able to play this yourself, you know, and go on this adventure. So that's how I started. And I remade my video, made it a lot better this time. I filled up my background check, my phone interview. I went to LA and somehow made it mid-April 2017. I got a call from my casting associate at work that I was to pack my bags because I was going to Fiji. And I will never forget that day. You know, it changed my life and I freaked out. I spent the next 5 weeks going all in on Survivor prep, and yeah.
Talk to us about that preparation process quickly, because I know for a lot of people, they get the call, they're dizzy with excitement, and they instantly go back and start binging old seasons and bulking up, and they do everything they can to prepare. For you, given your history, was this more of a structured process? Was this just another case study, or was it more haphazard than that?
I love it. It was absolutely a case study for me. And I'm just that kind of person, you know? And so maybe that's why it's not that management consulting made me who I am. It's more like I think I chose management consulting because what I have to do in that industry fits the type of person that I am. I'm highly structured. I love schedules and to-do lists, and I love, you know, processes and stuff like that.
Color coding and post-it notes.
I hate that part, but, you know. So as soon as I got the call in November 2016, I started binge watching. So throughout my week off from work at back at home for Christmas, every single weekend that I had, I started binge watching. I think I went through about 16 seasons before flying out, starting with Game Changers and Millennials Gen X, all the way back to about China. And I skipped a few in between that they told me to skip because they sucked. So I did that, and the rest of the preparation really began in earnest once I got the call that I was in. So that was, I actually starved myself for a week before bulking up. And so for a week, I practiced eating one meal a day, that was breakfast. And after work, at around 9 p.m., I would go to the hotel gym and try to like work out really hard to really feel like, to really get a sense of what challenges plus the starvation would be like. And then I began the bulk up process. I went to the dietitian. I told her, I have to bulk up. And so she said, why? And I said, I'm going to go on this summer camp that involves starving, and I cannot tell you more. So she said, okay. So we came up with this 6,000 calorie a day plan, a lot of complex carbs and protein. It was like, imagine a Cole Meadows daily diet. But for me, that was a typical, that was my special diet. That's Cole's typical diet. So I did that. I worked out like crazy. I went to practice swimming and diving. That worked out really well, obviously. I then really started taking notes even. You know, so for instance, when I watched a season like Micronesia or China, I took notes on how the alliances form and how they change throughout the swaps and the merge. I took notes on what the challenges can be boiled down to. What kind of skills do you need to win individual immunity or travel immunity? Notes on like the things that people lied about and how they lied about those aspects of their backgrounds, that kind of stuff. I told my job and I was ready to quit to go on Survivor, which actually is something that a couple of people did on my season. And to give them credit, their reaction was more, they were so pumped and they told me, you know, go do your thing. Good luck. Come back whenever you can. And we'll give you a new project to jump on when you're back. And so they gave me the green light. I took a leave of absence beginning mid-May. And then the last 2 weeks I had my whole life just thinking and dreaming about Survivor. So it was a really fun 5 week process between getting the call and flying out to Fiji.
And when you were taking those notes, were there any particular pearls of wisdom that you were able to derive from that? Any patterns that really leapt out at you?
I believe so. And I have a mustache in storage in New York City now, but I believe some things that stood out to me were, you know, for instance, the alliances form early, right? So no matter what the reason is, if somebody comes to you day one and says, I want to work with you, the answer is yes. Whatever people tell you throughout the season, the answer is yes. You tell them, yes, I'd love to. Then you think about it, right? Or for instance, yes, the importance of having five or six people that are on your side on day one. Because at the end of the day, the first few votes always go along the lines of who do we dislike, who is annoying, or who's in the minority that we can pick off of. Things like the importance of, you know, strength to body weight ratio, especially in the individual phase where a lot of challenges are about pain tolerance or balancing or endurance, right? What else? I will say it really focused more on those parts of the game because when it came to survival, you know, I didn't have any background in camping or outdoor expertise, but I did believe that I had that grit to just like tough it out if things got really shitty. And so about the exhaustion, the starvation, the paranoia, I think I was, you know, tough enough to deal with that just as the game went on. And you saw, we didn't complain about the Malolo shelter. That wasn't us, you know? Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, it really focused more on what are the tangible skills that I can learn right now that'll help me get to the end.
What kind of expectations did you have for yourself entering the game?
So I kept the mindset that, like, I felt, I truly believed that I could win, that I had what it takes to win Survivor. But I didn't go in thinking, oh, like, I got in the bag. It's a piece of cake, right? If anybody tells you that pregame, like, if they tell Jeff or, like, Aaron from ET Canada or Josh or Gordon, I'm going to win this thing, I feel like that's not the right mindset in my perspective, because there are so many twists and turns throughout one season of Survivor that the winner that's standing there at the end as the sole survivor has gone there through some combination of God-given luck and innate skill. And so I went in more thinking that I have what it takes to win, and I believe that, but I'm going to take it step by step. And so, funny enough, my first box to check off was make the merge. That didn't happen. But it was, you know, make the merge, make the loved ones visit, then make the finale episode was my realistic goal. And so if I were in the final six or seven, I think I would have been able to be totally happy about my outcome. Other things I want to check off were, you know, pull off a blindside, win individual immunity, and just come back. And I truly meant this, come back to the real world with some like really good friends that I've met through Survivor. And, you know, some of those I checked off, some of those I didn't. But maybe there will be another shot, you know?
Well, I really like that approach that you described. Like, to me, going in saying, oh, I definitely am going to win this is basically no different than going into, like, a poker tournament saying, oh, I'm definitely going to win this. Like, no one could ever have that kind of control over any season of Survivor to make that kind of guarantee. And people who say that sort of thing, it generally is a pretty good indicator that they're, to some extent, probably not approaching this on the correct kind of level.
Yeah. So, for instance, this is the kind of game that demands your respect and humility. And so to go in so arrogant that you think, yeah, I got this in the bag, is, I think, unhealthy. And that's the kind of guy that I am. Like, if, like, faced with this amazing show that's not just a show but a test of your willpower, your, like, how you fight against adversity, how you respond to these, you know, twists and turns, all the while starving and not sleeping enough and all that. It was a humbling test. And so I wanted to give it my A game and to really fight hard and play hard and see at the end of the 39 days where I would end up and what I would learn about myself and the other castaways. And yeah, I think that approach, you know, is a pretty good one for any newbie going to Survivor.
How invested would you say you were in your outcome here? Because you see people who are massive fans of the show, and it's really a big part of their own identity. And so if they finally get the chance to live their dream and it doesn't go the way they hope or the way they expect, that's a crushing blow to them. Whereas for you, it felt like, oh, this sounds like a cool adventure and a cool challenge, but I have a lot of other stuff going on in my life, and this wasn't something that I've been holding in my mind as a vision for the past 10 years or so. So it felt for you like it was more of a something which, if it goes well, then it's all upside, and if it doesn't, well, that's unfortunate, but I can pick myself up and move on fairly quickly.
That's partially true, but I have this ability to really just get invested in things, you know, and I'm hyper competitive. So once that seed was planted in my head, November 2016, then all I could dream of was going on Survivor and kicking ass and taking home the $1 million check and being this huge role model for Asian Americans and all of that on TV. I got really invested in the whole process. And so going in, I did have the mindset of I'm playing with house money. This wasn't my lifelong dream or goal. This is more like a fun adventure that I want to, like, it'll give me, you know, like, really cool life stories down the road, and it'll give me a new set of friends and a new community, and I'll be on TV. Nobody, you know, there's no bad fame, as some people put it. And so,
do you agree with that quickly? Do you agree that there's no such thing as bad publicity?
From a very cynical point of view, yes. Like, for instance, like Donald Trump, right? Like, his fame did help him become a politician and win the election. Like, if you want to take the approach of, is fame good for you, like, becoming a good person or having a healthy career, whatever, the answer is no. But is fame a useful tool to achieve a certain objective that you have in mind? I always, the answer is yes, I believe.
Would going out there and having closer to like the Jacob Derwin experience still have been worthwhile to you?
No.
Okay.
I feel like going out there, the funny thing is, looking back, yes, I got 15th place and I was a pre-merge boot, but there are so many silver linings that I am able to look back really happily and say that, yes, I didn't get as far as I wanted to at all, but I learned so much and I grew so much and I gained so much from Survivor. But if you had asked me pre-game, like if you had asked me on press day, so James, you're going to be a pre-merge boot, how do you feel? I would have probably said very shitty. And yes, you know, for a while after my exit, you know, at Ponderosa, a little bit on the trip, you know, it did feel really, you know, gutting that my dream of, I guess, a year and a half came to a close like this. But right now, looking back, I'm able to maintain a really healthy lens on the whole journey. The result does play a big role, but, you know, that was the hand that I was dealt.
And I guess given your professional background, you're used to thinking of things in terms of the process rather than the outcome. And you understand that any game like this is going to have a high level of variance involved. At the same time, though, it is a very high stakes game. It's something which most people will only get to play once. And it's a game which means a lot to you and something you really want to do well at. So even though you understand on some level that you did everything you could right, and maybe there were a few mistakes along the way, but by and large, you did a good job. I imagine emotionally, it's hard to actually embrace that and come to terms with that when you go out so much earlier than you would have hoped for.
I'll say so. And the times when it really hurts were, for instance, you know, after my boot, we kept on watching the merge feast. That felt like just a stab to my chest, you know, or watching the 8 castaways meet their family members and just break down in tears. And I wanted to be there. You know, I wanted to be that guy crying in my dad's arms and him coming out from Seoul, Korea to see me on national TV. We all have dreamed of that moment for so long and we got really invested. And so, yes, it was tough. But at the same time, you know, for instance, we got an amazing consolation prize from CBS in the form of the pre-jury trip that we had an amazing time at. I got to know a lot of these people on the pre-jury like really well, and there are a lot of good people on this season. And you know, even just my outcome, like I wouldn't make an excuse and say that I got voted out purely because of the swap. I could have done things better, but a lot of people have come to me and said that you got swap screwed. And if that's the case, and if it's not the case that I screwed something up really badly, like the die, for instance, and that caused my boot directly, to know that that's not the case is, you know, a little bit comforting.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you know, like, yes, I'm a pre-merge boot, but there are things to really, you know, just take away from that and cherish. And I'm trying to do that, you know.
I always think the weirdest thing has got to be the people who get voted out of Big Brother early. They leave on, like, day 12 or day 19 or whatever, and then they have to spend the next 80 some days watching their season play out in real time over the course of the summer, thinking like, if only I'd done a couple things differently, I would still potentially be in there on this show that I'm currently watching.
So I actually didn't know how that's how that works.
Yeah.
Because Big Brother is a live show technically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
gotcha.
It airs as it's going on. They do 3 weekly episodes, and it's all happening The game, they're like 24/7 live feeds. 24/7 being very loose terminology. They're often down. But it's a whole different experience, I would imagine, being one of the early boots on Big Brother. There's no like vacation they get to go on or anything. They just get no money and have to go home.
Oh yeah, that sucks because, you know, getting to go to Brisbane and Cairns and, you know, go out clubbing in Brisbane, go diving in the Great Barrier Reef, all for free. You know, it's a thing that I think we were told that it's been a thing since season two, that Mark Burnett saw how the pre-merge boots of season one reacted. And he literally was like, guys, we're going to give the pre-jury something to do the second half of the season. And so it was under his directive that they designed this pre-jury trip. And it's been a tradition ever since. And as a pre-jury boot myself, that was such a great consolation prize. And it really helped us forget about that painful outcome and just focus on bonding as a group and having fun with each other. So
yeah, well, I actually was going to ask this later on, but this seems like a good spot. When you're on that pre-jury trip, is there much speculation amongst the group about what's going on back on the island, or are you really able to just focus on enjoying yourselves?
We go back and forth. And so, for instance, every night, once people get kind of drunk, then the topic does naturally go back to, oh, it's day blank. I bet if, you know, this tribe loses, I bet this person's now in Ponderosa. Or if it's post-merge, I bet, you know, if it's this challenge, I bet blank wins immunity. And yeah, I bet blank goes home. You try to really speculate. And at the end of the season, we try to also guess who wins and all that. So, yes, it's, you know, really hard to just forget about what we had just gone through completely. But at the same time, they do keep us very just active, you know, just exploring our destinations and going ziplining, going diving, going out. And so for the future pre-merge boots, like, yes, it sucks, but you guys will have an amazing time on that trip. So there's something to look forward to.
Yeah, silver lining. And I guess it makes a lot of sense. Like, you guys don't have a ton of other things you all know that much about other than the players that are in the game that you know is happening. So story checks out that there's at least some discussion going on about how all that's playing out. But James, let's get into day one here for you, back when you're still in the game on the island and you get out and you meet your tribe and Jeff Probst is there telling you about your new season, Survivor Ghost Island. What was your reaction to finding out about this theme and this twist?
Yeah, so on day one, we were woken up around, I want to say, 2:30 a.m. by actually, fun fact, the alarm that first day is always Ancient Voices, our theme song. So that is a pretty apt way to wake up. You get goosebumps. You feel it. It's the day that this whole journey begins. And so we get wardrobe checked. We get put on our boats. The two boats that you saw in the opening, we got on those and started driving off to the island with the opening challenge. The small tidbit here is that we got our buffs on the way to the opening challenge. And so it wasn't like a season like 35 where it became an actual scene of Jeff handing out buffs and people freaking out in joy and getting to see their tribe name and stuff. We just got it, you know, behind the camera. But I got my buff, opened it up, said Malolo. Little did I know that I would be part of a curse back then. But we did see the logo. It said Ghost Island. And I remember we were in lockdown, so we couldn't talk even back then. But we looked around on the Malolo boat and just all shrugged because it wasn't an actual theme. It was probably some kind of island that was going to be part of our season, like Exile or Redemption. And we wanted to know what it was about. So we get there on the mat, and then we go to the scene that you saw during the premiere. So Jeff goes, you know, welcome to Survivor, Ghost Island. And so, like, this season we were bringing back the old haunted relics and mistakes of past players. My immediate reaction was more the relief that I had studied my Survivor history. I knew that I was going to be one of the many recruits of the season. And so being in a position where I actually can recognize past players and their blunders and talk about it with my tribe, I felt some relief. Whereas I you know, honestly think that if I were in Noble's position, I would have been like, oh, shit, you know, I don't know much about Survivor still, but I have to now play a season centered around Survivor history. But we all thought it was an amazing twist. We got to the beach, and as a tribe, we discussed that twist, and we all loved it because it's a really ingenious way to celebrate the fact that this show has been on air for 36 seasons, right? imagine doing a Ghost Island type show with, I don't know, like a much newer show. There's no history to lean on. And so the fact that they can pull off a season like this just is a testament to how rich of a history that Survivor has, and the players that have come and gone, and the plays that they've made, and the mistakes that they've made. So we loved it. And day one, we just got to, you know, building a fire, building a shelter, gathering some coconuts, and just gathering around. And I will say that what really struck out to me was that we talked a lot about, because of the theme, just Survivor. And it was obvious to me that a lot of people on Malolo were super fans. So I mean, not just Donathan and Jacob, but also people like Brendan and Stephanie Johnson, who had been fans since 2000, and they had watched every single season since then. And so I played up the fan side of me as well. And so without saying that I was a recruit, I made sure that I, you know, chipped in some factoids here and there, and let people know that I knew my Survivor history as well. Yeah. So that worked.
Yeah.
And so we talked about me being a recruit. Postseason, Jacob confessed to me that even he was impressed at how much Survivor history that I knew, while him fully knowing that I was a recruit, because he knew everything about me, and we can talk about that as well. But I even, you know, impressed the super fan Jacob. So I think I did my homework decently well, you know.
A Harvard guy makes a lot of sense, I think. One thing I would love to hear about, if you're able to talk about it, when did you find out about the Final Four fire twist, and what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, so that was a thing that Jeff told us pregame. So it had been in place for 35, but we hadn't seen 35 play out. So he came to us pregame, and he gave us a nice pep talk about how this is a great cast. You guys are going to, you know, be a part of a great season, so go out there and play hard. And by the way, FYI, we have this twist in place. Our thought, honestly, I mean, we were in lockdown, so we couldn't discuss it much, but my thought was that, oh, that's so far down the road. Like, I'll worry about the Final Four when I get to the Final Six or Seven.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to get to the merge first, like that kind of thought process. And I guess it did end up playing a very crucial role in our end game, it turns out. But I would assume that most of the cast, like me, thought, oh, that's way down the road. So I want to focus on my early game first.
Well, as you were focusing on that early game and you guys get to the Malolo Beach, what were your first impressions of the people who ended up on your tribe?
So it was overwhelmingly positive, in the sense that, and this is true, there was no real conflict on Malolo. So for instance, if you go back in history, most of the first boots throughout Survivor history, most of them have been either lazy or weak or annoying. Gonzalez was none of those. Gonzalez went home because she was a good player and a threat early on. And so when I say that there was no conflict, yes, there was, you know, what Jacob alluded to when he said there's like the Pretty People Alliance. That's to some extent true. And there were some alliances forming on early. But at the same time, there was real harmony, in the sense that, and I want to give Brendan credit here, because Brendan truly became the de facto captain of Malolo. I mean, he was chosen as our captain for the opening challenge. And so he took on this role of, you know, camp counselor. And we were a bunch of kids anyway, so that it kind of made sense. And we all just worked hard and kept ourselves. And there was no real drama on Malolo. I think, and I believe this, I think Dom and Chris being on the same tribe was almost like by design. And, you know, we all knew that that was going to result in some explosive drama. And so that being on Navidi, I think Malolo just had that, the more, I don't know, the nice guys, you know, people that love Survivor, want to play the game and have fun, and want to be cooperative and collaborative. And so none of us had a problem putting in our hard work towards the chores and stuff. And so it truly felt like summer camp until we lost the first challenge, to be honest.
Yeah. One thing, actually, thank you for mentioning it, because I totally skipped it. Before you even got to the Malolo Beach, you had that opening challenge where you almost became the team leader. Talk us through that, because I'm guessing that was not your dream start to the game, based on having seen the fate of a lot of early leaders in Survivor history.
Yeah, so to get there, I want to insert a little side story here. I'll try to make it brief, but Jacob knew who I was pregame. And so he had found everything about me before flying to Fiji. And this happened because during finals week, we were in the same subgroup that eats together, that works out together. And so I saw him and he saw me at the hotel gym where we worked out for 30 minutes daily. You know, I was wearing a nondescript black tank top and blue shorts, whatever. You know, I wasn't wearing a Harvard jersey by any means. I'm not stupid. But Jacob saw me work out. According to him, he saw my legs and he saw that I had big quads and deduced, okay, he probably runs track or does triathlon or some shit. And then he also said, okay, Asian guy. Most Asians on Survivor are pretty smart. And so what he did was went back home and looked up the men's track and triathlon rosters of the top 25 colleges in America until he found an Asian guy, and that was me. Once he finds my name, he finds my LinkedIn, which has everything about me. So that's what he literally knows about me pregame.
So you got doxxed by Jacob on your beach?
No. So, and this plays out in a pretty funny way. He also found Donathan and one more castaway. He told me he found three of us before the game even began. And this is, it's a testament to how, like, invested he was. You know, his prep also included, like spying on us, and he did find a lot of us pre-game even. All right, so we get to the beach. Jacob knows who exactly I am, including the fact that I was a Harvard track captain, which is why when Jeff goes, pick your leader, and we are all just looking at our feet. You know, nobody wants to volunteer because why would you? Jacob was the first one to look up and point at me and go, you look strong. I think you should be captain. And he told me post-game that was precisely because he knew I was an actual captain in real life. And so for him, it was more of a matter of just be captain again. And so that happened. And I, in my mind, you know, my heart skipped a beat and I was, you know, oh, hell no. Like, I cannot be captain this early. I know what happened to So Kim. So I, you know, gesture towards Brendan and I go, hey, but, you know, like, I think this gentleman over here seems like a natural leader. Like, he's also strong, really charismatic. Like, do you feel like you could be captain? So I kind of, you know, deflected it towards Brendan. And Brendan suggested that we do rock, paper, scissors. And we drew for four rounds. He lost on the fifth and he became captain. So that's how it ended up becoming Brendan. I think, to be honest, everybody expected it to be Brendan. So at the end of the day, him becoming captain served the narrative. But looking back, you know, it would have been kind of fresh to see, like, me be a captain for once and standing up there against Chris Noble, I will say. So that's the story behind the captain thing. And I will say, like, I really wish that Brendan chose me for either of the two legs, either the running part or the slide puzzle, because, well, I'm a sprinter, but also I had mastered the slide puzzle before flying out. And so, I mean, a lot of us, like, even I was talking to Jacob and Donathan while the challenge was going on, that we all knew how to crush slide puzzles. And so I think I would have done well in either leg, but at the end of the day, we won, and that's all that matters. And so we're off to a strong start. We get to the beach. Day one, I think in the afternoon, Jacob goes to get firewood and calls me over. And so we're, like, you know, on a walk. Obviously, we're going to talk about some strategy while collecting firewood. And Jacob goes, you know, I think you're, like, you have a good head on your shoulders. I want to, like, align with you and play with you. And I'm, like, really happy. So, you know, I respond, hey, I appreciate you saying that. I feel the same way. I got your back if you have mine. And then he goes on to say, and I also think you're lying about everything. And so I'm just taken aback. And I say, like, what do you mean? And he goes, I think you are a business professional, which is true. And I think you went to an Ivy League school, which is true. And so I freak out because in my mind, the image is him reading me like a book, not him knowing my entire profile, but because he didn't say that. I just felt like he just read me completely. Like, and so I, you know, got really defensive. And my response actually was accusing him of stereotyping me. So I was, you know, so I said, are you saying this just because I'm Asian? You're like, you can't do that, dude. And so Jacob had to be on the defensive and he stepped way back and he said, I'm so sorry about that. I totally trust you, I guess. If he had told me, I know who you are, like, just stop this, I would have probably conceded. But I honestly didn't get that feeling. I thought he had an amazing read on me. And so I wanted to prevent him from thinking that way. But it turns out, you know, he knew everything. And I think he told me that he only told Stephanie Johnson about who I really am before he got booted. So Johnson did know my real story. And this all came to light when I joined him at Ponderosa. And I get there and I'm about to break my big, you know, secret. And so I chug my beer and I'm like, guys, so I've been lying to you the whole time. I'm not really a track coach. And Jacob goes, stop. And he recites my entire LinkedIn profile from start to finish. So that's how I actually knew that he had known everything about me the entire time.
Yeah.
Has Jacob been lying to us too? He's not a voiceover artist. He's actually a spy or a private detective or something.
He actually works for the FBI.
Yeah.
He works in cyber intelligence. Yeah. But
it's like Jonah Hill in 21 Jump Street. That's like that kind of situation.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it sounds, based on what I've heard, during like week one exit press, or I guess during exit press after the premiere episode with the first two vote-offs, like Jacob was not doing too strong of a job kind of ingratiating himself in the group early. Was that kind of the main headline at Malolo with no other real conflict going on?
Jacob's main downfall was that he just played too hard. I think because if you go back and look at our pregame stuff, he's the one that has gotten rave reviews from all of us. We all loved him pregame. We got really good vibes from him, that he was a fan. He was super nice and down to earth, which is all true. The only problem is that as soon as we hit the beach, he started playing at 100%. And so, you know, the idol hunting scene that you saw was real. And even things like the sock rise that I wasn't there, but I believe Stephanie Johnson walked back to camp and saw him do it, and then she told us. And so it was painfully obvious that he was just playing a little bit too hard out of the gate. And if you do that, it makes you a prime target, because my mentality for sure was anybody but me.
Yeah.
So if you make yourself stand out like that, that's no bueno.
Queen stays queen.
Yep.
With Gonzalez leaving because of, you know, being one of the bigger threats, and Jacob was off on Ghost Island for that vote, and then it seemed pretty much foregone that Jacob was going to go once you guys lost that next challenge. But before we get to the first swap, I'm curious to know what kind of discussion was going on as things pertain to idols during these early days, because we'll see Michael and Brendan ultimately find this Malolo idol. It's shown after the swap happens. But were there any kind of like suspicions about who might have it? Like apparently, you know, Jacob being spotted going through the rice, anything along those lines happening during these first couple of days?
So I think days one and two, our collective group mentality was there's obviously an idol here. But legitimately, I don't think anybody except for Jacob ever went off alone in those first 2 days because of, and I think, again, this was more a summer camp of just people that wanted to have fun and not play the game too hard just yet. And so the only variable factor there was, does Jacob have it? Has he already found it or not? And so, for instance, before Tribal 2, when it was, you know, Jacob targeting Michael, them splitting votes on me and Jacob and that kind of stuff, we went through Jacob's stuff. And so his bags, his clothes, everything, to make sure that he didn't actually have a real idol to cover for his fake idol from Ghost Island. But at the same time, as for the real Malolo idol, we had such, again, it's like this, like, camp group mentality. I don't think anybody ever felt like they had to go find it that early. And plus, it was Brendan who kept pretty, you know, he kept a pretty good eye on everybody to make sure that nobody was going off alone. And as soon as somebody did, that was Jacob, he just got sent home. So I don't think idols were a big topic for anybody on Malolo. I will say that having watched the premiere, I was so impressed by how Dominic found his idol. And I think that this is a pretty smart move for anybody to go at night when people are sleeping and to try to, it's going to be real difficult, but to try to find an idol in the dark of night, I think was a very ballsy move that I think he deserves a lot of credit for. Because if you do that, you're never seen going off alone. And if you're lucky enough to find an idol, that's yours, and you know that nobody else on that early tribe has an idol. And I think this is where the information piece comes into play, because, and I'm a big subscriber to the theory that Survivor is in large part a game about information and information imbalance that I mentioned in the second tribal. If you have that idol, let's say pre-swap, then you know that that beach is idle, you have it. And so whenever you have to scheme and plot down the road, you can rule out a lot of scenarios. And that gives you the power because you have an idol that you know that these many people definitely don't. And so I think that's crucial, but on Malolo, that wasn't a focal point at all.
It sounds like you weren't too concerned about your own position in terms of going home or being in danger, but how secure did you feel with how these alliances seemed to be linking up in those early days? Did you feel like you were at the center of what was going on?
I will say that I was not in the majority alliance that was presented to us. And so that was something along the lines of Libby, Johnson, Jenna, Brendan, Michael. At the same time, I had ins with, among that alliance, I had ins with Brendan and Stephanie Johnson. And so we were going off on talks with each other throughout the days. But for me, I think, my early alliance comprised of Donathan for sure, Laurel, Brendan and Johnson to some extent, and Jacob. And so as long as I knew that they were feeding me information and I was feeding them information, I knew that I was going to be fine. Because if you think about it, if you have all your bases covered in terms of the factions, and so if I have somebody who has my back in each of those big alliances, then I know that if I'm targeted, I'll get that information back pretty quickly. And so it's not so much that you have to be the majority alliance early on. It's more that you have to have alliances with the right people that can give you the most complete set of information back to you. That's kind of how I approach the early game.
Yeah.
And even talking about that second, like days 4, 5, and 6, we all know what happened in the challenge, and I'd be happy to dive deeper into that, pun not intended, but it's a pretty good pun. So what happened there was, as soon as Donathan got sent to Ghost Island and it wasn't Jacob, we all knew without speaking a word that it was going to be Jacob. And so you see me get back to camp and apologize to Malolo, and I did truly mean that apology. That was one of the worst days of my life, even to this day, that the sinking feeling that me as an athlete and a competitor.
Sinking feeling?
That's a good one. Yeah, I couldn't do that out there. That sinking feeling that I cost my team something that huge, tribal immunity, it really sucked. And so I really wanted to apologize. And, you heard me say I hate myself at tribal. I truly did hate myself that day. So yeah. Thankfully, though, the silver lining was that Jacob was there and he was obviously the prime target. And so the majority alliance pulled me aside after my apology once we split up. And they reassured me that, dude, look, you choked, but that's a one-off mistake. We don't want to boo you for that. It's Jacob. We all know that, right? And so my offer to people like Brendan or Stephanie Johnson was, okay, then let me help you. So let me paint Jacob the picture that he's in control. Let me help out with that. And then we can work our votes and send him home instead and help him feel secure throughout the day. So then I went to Jacob and Laurel and Co. and said, oh, I'm so scared because, Brendan just pulled me aside and he gave me a big beating. Like, he's pissed at me. Like, I think they're going to target me today. I'm so scared. And, Jacob told me, oh, no, it's all good. I got the numbers. We're going to target Michael. So he said, me, you, Laurel, Donathan, Johnson, one more person. We're going to vote out Michael. So I was like, awesome. And then I went back to Michael and said, hey, Michael, I think Jacob's going to target you. And so it was a back and forth game. And what you see at Tribal is partially the acting that we all did of, I am scared. Brendan and Jenna are pissed at me. Jacob's feeling secure now because everything that he thinks is true is happening at Tribal live. At the end of the day, we were able to send him home. And look, like face value, I've now gotten to know him really well as a person outside of the game as well. And I also knew even then how much this meant to him. And so it was gutting to send him home that early. But at the end of the day, for my game, the best way for me to save myself after that big blunder was to send the obvious target home. And about those two votes, that was a scenario that I was able to predict before heading off to tribal. And so I sat down with a producer in a confessional and I told him, so in my mind, if things are working out the way I think it is, that our big group is just going to target Jacob. But this is after Jacob has given us this big spiel about him having found an idol on Ghost Island. He's going to play no matter what. So to hedge against that possibility of Jacob having a real idol, I think they might split the votes two on me and two on me, such that we all know that Jacob's going to vote for Michael. Then if Jacob's idol is real, then I go home instead. And so it's a pretty good way for that group to hedge their bets against that possibility. And I was fine with it because I'd gone through Jacob's bag and clothes and we had all done that together. And I was about 99% sure that Jacob didn't have an idol. So given that scenario, I was fine taking those two votes because I didn't want to make a big deal of, you know, becoming the secondary target. Yeah. When at the end of the day, as long as I don't go home, I don't care.
Right.
Vote, send me votes. All I want is it's all good. So, yes, day six was one of the most harrowing days of my game by far. And at the end, things did work out, thank God. And then we get to swap, which blossomed my game. So
You got off to a pretty rough start, at least challenge-wise, with Malolo losing the first two. And in particular, I'm sure that second one was not an easy pill to swallow. But then you show up to this swap, and it's you, Laurel, Libby, and Donathan heading over to Navidi, where you're going to join up with Dom and Wendell, along with Morgan and Angela. And even though you had that rough kind of first couple of days in the game, it seems like there are going to be some pretty serious cracks here on the Navidi tribe, and all hope is not lost just yet.
Yeah, the feeling that we got when, man, we pull up to Navidi Beach, and first of all, it's an actual resort. They have a living room, a kitchen, a gorgeous shelter that's much better than ours, and they even have a small forest off to the side into the jungle. That looks like a botanical garden. It's gorgeous. And they have big, tall trees providing shade and stuff. And so, you know, we got there, got a nice little tour. And then you saw Chris and Angela pull me and Libby aside to give us a pitch. And as soon as Chris said, I think something along the lines of, I don't think you guys have to worry. There are cracks within Navidi. I turned to her and we like high-five each other behind their backs. And the camera was in front of Chris, so it didn't capture us. But, man, it was such a good feeling to know that we had a fighting chance. And so then it became more of a this process of, okay, so let's figure out what the crack is, what do we know, and how can we deliver the single maximum blow to Navidi with one single vote. And that's what you saw play out amongst us four through those 3 days. And to be selfish, you know, for me to go from that low point of my game by definitely to possibly the highlight of my game and this memorable blindside that, you know, the edit showed me to be the single leader of that. I was very, very happy about it. Very thankful of the edit. And that day I got like phone calls and texts from alumni being like, dude, like that was awesome. I think somebody like Dawson or somebody said it was like one of the top five premier shows of all time.
Wow.
And it was humbling to be a part of that piece of, you know, Survivor history like that.
Yeah, so, well, talk us through how you ended up coming to that decision of Morgan being the one that made the most sense for you guys.
So, okay, so before I get into all that, I got to talk about Morgan. This is a woman that, like, I'm 100% serious, could win Survivor. She has all the tools, the physical game, the social game, the strategic game. Well, the strategic game we never got to see, but it was obvious to me talking game with her that she knew what's going on. She has what it takes to win, okay? Like, if you play this season out 20 times, you'll see about, I want to say, between 10 and 15 winners. That being said, she did nothing wrong except for just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, so no, I think that's a very common thing for a lot of pre-merge players that they, under different circumstances, could have very seriously been contenders for sure.
Yeah. And so, yes, I blindsided her out of the game, but I want to give her her due credit because that girl, like, she's amazing. And she's a great friend of mine now post-game as well. And she was able to put that, you know, vote behind her and truly welcome me to Ponderosa and bond with me as a friend. So that being said, how this began was the Civil War was painfully obvious. And so Chris and Angela told me and Libby. Then we told Laurel and Donathan, and just observing things around camp even, man, like Dom and Chris would not stop going at each other. It was like high school, like rivals in high school. It was insane. And so it got to the point where we all knew that we were not going to be targeted, even if we lose the next challenge. Now, then you see us lose and we come back. And then Wendell and Morgan pitched to us the idea of voting out Angela. And Dom gives us this whole spiel about his fake idol and real idol and fooling Chris and all that you see on TV. I think for me, the first warning sign was what you saw. So me telling Laurel and Donathan, if anybody ever has to say, I swear my kids and family, not a good sign. Because it means that somebody's so desperate to win my trust that they're willing to go to the extreme end. And remember, Game Changers was our most recent season. Sarah Lacina won playing a pretty brutal game based on that lie. And so I was really worried to hear that phrase come out of his mouth. And then about the whole idol thing, that was more of me playing out the scenarios in my head. So what if it's true? What if it's false? And then what happens to our decision tree and all that? So to even like hear back my confessional air about how Dom's fake idol might be a ploy for a real idol, which was all true. And I don't even know how that happened. Like, I just, like, said it, you know, and it turned out to be all true. But I think once that was established, and I think behind the scenes, Chris may have told us that he saw the real parchment. That's why I had that read. Because if that's true and Dom has an actual real idol parchment in possession, he actually has a real idol. So given all these bits of information, we build a picture, mainly me and Laurel together, of, okay, so I think Dom has a real idol. He's showing us a fake idol. They're voting for Angela, they claim. That's true. That could be true. That could be false. But if we as a foursome vote for another Navidi, it doesn't matter whether Dom's telling us the truth or not. We will still always have the majority vote. I think that's how we ended up deciding on a target. Now, if you go through the other Navidi targets that were with us at the point in time, Chris was gone on Ghost Island. Dom we want to keep because Dom and Chris, that split is what's giving us the edge. And so we want to keep those two alive as long as possible. So it leaves us Wendell and Morgan. I honestly didn't really have a strong preference. And that's when you see Laurel pitch to us, we need Wendell for challenges. Now, in retrospect, we all know that Morgan could have been a challenge beast herself. So looking back, it's kind of like an iffy reason to give to why we should keep Wendell over Morgan, a Division I diver and a killer whale trainer. But, you know, I honestly didn't really mind. And so Laurel wants Wendell to stay. Then it's Morgan. So you vote on Morgan. I think that was an example of, yes, it's an example of how a minority could exploit a crack in a majority and flip the game on them upside down. But at the same time, it worked out because the four of us had this innate trust within each other. And so once, you know, Laurel and I were on the same page the entire time. I knew for a fact that me and Donathan were on the same page. And so if I told him a target, if he told me a target, we would be voting together no matter what. And as, you know, as long as I convinced Libby, and that was a lot tougher than was shown on TV, then, you know, we knew we had the edge. And so just watching that final vote come out, when I believe it was 3 Morgan, 3 Angela, 1 Libby, and the final vote came out and it was Morgan. And I knew that Libby had sided with us at the end. And that was, I've got to say, one of the greatest feelings ever.
Having seen the season play out now, is there part of you that wishes you had put the hard sell on Laurel the way you did with Libby and tried to get Wendell as a target there instead?
I mean, yeah, consequentially, absolutely. The two men that we let walk unscathed that night ran the whole show post-merge. it's funny how things work out. But at the same time, I think I valued my alliance with Laurel so much that at that point in time, that I wasn't really ready to just force her into a tough spot like I did with Libby. And I, even that, like, post coming back from Tribal, I pulled her aside and told her, like, how sorry I was that I forced her to vote out her friend, and that moving on, I would always give her, like, the pick of a target, and I would go along with her plan. And I didn't mean it because, man, she was, like, crying at the well. She told me she can't possibly do that. Like, can we please not go for Morgan? And it took a lot more time than was shown for me to convince her. So, yeah, I mean, looking back, hindsight's 2020, Dom or Wendell would have been pretty great targets. You know, if we go with Wendell, the winner actually goes home in 18th place. Just think about that, right? But I do think that at that point in time, I acted with the best information available to me. So,
yeah, I think that makes sense. And I know after that vote went your way, something that I'm sure came up on the island and I know has come up after the game has all played out for you is the idea of, now that we have what seems to be a good group going here, why not throw a couple of these challenges and pick off some Navitis? So what was the discussion like about that in real time?
Yeah, that's absolutely my biggest regret looking back. I think that's just a part of what shows my shortcomings that I had as a Survivor newbie player. Jeff told us pregame, play as if it's your second time, play hard, take risks. And that's what I should have done. So, I mean, I did it with the Morgan blindside, but if I were a great player, I should have just kept on hammering the Navitis by losing challenges. So what actually ended up happening was the next morning, me and Laura went down to the beach. We had a nice little high five session. Things worked out. This is perfect. And so we both saw right through the situation that we were now up 4 strong against a splintered 2-2 Navidi situation. So whichever side we chose, we were going to be up 6-2. Now, that's a supermajority that allows us to split a vote 3-3 without the fear of a correct idol play, because even if it's correct, the other person just goes home. So it was all like, it was like a dream come true for us. The problem is, then we went on to, okay, so should we throw a challenge? Should we lose the next one on purpose? And both of us just ended up dismissing the idea after about 10, 15 minutes of discussion, because I think A, it was just that psychology of, we had lost back to back to back challenges and we wanted to just win for once. You know, winning felt good in the opening challenge. We wanted to win again. And also, what if, you know, in the off chance, you know, we throw the challenge and one of us goes home, that makes us look like complete idiots on national TV. So that was the other scenario. But what we should have realized was that that second scenario of us throwing the challenge and the Navidi somehow magically bonding together, which is never going to happen with Dom and Chris battling each other. And also that psychological appeal of, yeah, like winning feels good. Yeah, I get it. But what's even better is voting out your opposing tribe and getting to what will be a second swap. We all knew there was going to be a second swap with my own tribe with the number advantage, you know, and that I should have seen that value down the road. And, you know, like, and that's where I admit, like, I could have been a better player if I had thought through, you know, those items. And if we had done that, then what happens is, let's assume hypothetically that we lose a fourth challenge. I think I would have wanted to side with Chris and Angela because it was obvious to me that they were less savvy players than Dom and Wendell. But if, you know, Laurel wanted to save Wendell again, yeah, I wouldn't have minded too much because my focal point would have probably been giving Malolo the majority finally at the second swap at 15. On that note, as soon as we saw the swap at 18, we were all fans enough to know that there was going to be another swap at 15 because we have seen past seasons that had follow that exact pattern.
Yeah, so I think you can know 100% it is happening at 15 or 14.
Yeah. So then let's say that we side with Dom and Wendell. Then we vote, split votes 3-3 on Chris and Angela, and they get just sent home back to back. Then we hit the second swap at 15 with Malolo, I believe, up 8-7 finally. That's what would have happened. And if that's the case, then mathematically, Malolo has to have a majority in at least one tribe. It has to, which didn't happen.
What do you think about the direction future seasons may be headed with that in mind. Because when we talked to Dominic, he talked to us in great detail about the merit of throwing that challenge to get rid of Bradley. And we asked him a little bit about if that's ever going to become accepted by the show, if they're ever going to not, as far as I can tell, try to shame the people who are throwing challenges in virtually every single context. And do you think there is a possibility, as more and more people come away from it saying to themselves, I wish I had been more open to throwing challenges, that at a certain point the show will, if it runs long enough, acknowledge the obvious strategic merit and the long-term thinking in doing such a thing?
I can see that happening. But it should be a little bit, I don't think it'll be a rapid change by any means, because, for instance, one of my favorite memories of PG that I respect a lot as a player is her and Jamie throwing the puzzle challenge in China, right, to send somebody home. And that plan worked out in their favor. Throwing challenges, I mean, even, yeah, Richard Hatch threw the final meeting challenge in season one. Throwing a challenge has been a part of our history for 18 years now. But I think the issue is, one, and Dominic alluded to this as well, and I completely agree, it almost is a disrespect to production that have spent months and months building the set for us to compete in. And so how dare we as competitors on a national TV show not, like, lose on purpose, right? And so that was, yes, a real fear of mine when I juggled with the idea, because, you know, that might really piss off Jeff or production. How dare this guy just sit there and not compete, you know? And so I would like some indication that they're fine with it. Now, my thought is that if throwing a challenge is TV gold, so for instance, the way PG and Jamie did it, or for instance, if I were solving the puzzle with Dom that we did on day 15, and if I had, like, knocked down the table and turned to Dom and said, Dom, we're going to travel tonight. Like, that would have been a fun way to throw a challenge. And Jeff would have probably loved it because it's good TV. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like as long as that happens, I feel like the fear of production being pissed at you now goes away. Then you run into the obstacle of just, it's human psychology. If you can win and if you can guarantee that you are safe, how can you possibly choose a path that puts you in a vulnerable position, right? Even if it's a 0.1%
chance. Final immunity challenge of Survivor Borneo and how he won by a one vote margin because he gave up the necklace to Kelly Wigglesworth. I think, like, that kind of foresight is how you justify it.
Yeah, and that's why Hatch will be forever a legend, right? And that's what made him the original sole survivor. And that psychology part got to me, because for me and Laurel, after having gone to back-to-back-to-back tribals, and having realized just how stressful they are, and even especially for me, because that involved me getting two votes and me leading a blind side that was not guaranteed to succeed, I now knew just how tough these tribals were. And I wanted to, you know, maybe be in a position for once where I could just sit back and have a nice dinner with the tribe and just go to sleep early, you know?
And for the record, I totally understand that impulse, by the way. Yeah. I feel like I'm coming across far more condescending than I mean to.
No. Like,
that could just be your epitaph, Colin.
I'm just pointing out that future players need to overcome these obstacles in order to really integrate the throwing challenge move as a part of their game. And if somebody can do that, that will make him or her a much better, much more threatening player for sure. So I love to see it happen, definitely.
And for you in particular, James, I know there are lots of people who go on the show and they say, I'm a competitor, I hate to lose, and you see this ingrained resistance to the idea of throwing challenges. But for you as an athlete who really values that and really enjoys that kind of competition, do you think that was another psychological barrier that got in the way of that?
Yeah, and this actually, that is a great point that reminds me, part of my situation was that 3 days prior, I had cost my team the win, right? And I didn't want to be the guy to go back and lose on purpose for my tribe again. For instance, like post-swap, my mentality was fully one of, wow, so I need to somehow redeem myself for my Malolo family, was kind of how I approached the Morgan vote. And I was able to do that. And so I was still reeling from the shock of, wow, like, I just sucked in that challenge. And so I really don't want to be the guy to lose on purpose again and send my own friends and allies back to Tribal Council. So, yeah, just putting all those factors together was, I think, what dissuaded me and Laurel from just pulling the trigger. And looking back, if we had, we would have had a completely different season post-merge.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And in particular, after you see Brendan get voted out at that next vote, it really seems like, based on what the two tribes would probably presume to be the case at the opposite camp at that point, in like the kind of Colin Stone's dream scenario, I guess, it would be both teams at that next challenge doing as much as they can to lose on purpose, or at least the majority of people on each of those teams. And I will happily admit that that is not probably going to be great television.
Yeah. Come to think of it, that's never happened in Survivor history. That would make for a pretty funny challenge. But I can see, you know, John Kirchhoffer and Jeff just getting pissed off, you know.
It would be fun if you had to play the challenge for the right to lose it. And I guess that would be the only way you could get around it.
Oh, yeah, maybe. What if a tribe does win and then tells Jeff, so, Jeff, so we win. Can we transfer the win to them? Or something like that.
That has happened. You know, have you seen Survivor One World? That literally happened.
I actually skipped One World because casting told me to skip it.
Yeah. You're not missing out on much other than that exact moment.
So it actually happened.
Yes, it did. It did indeed happen.
The thing is, that time the other tribe wanted to win. You know, they happily accepted the immunity. They didn't want to have to go. So we still haven't seen the both tribes trying to tank it yet. But as you said, Colin, I don't think that's in the near future anytime soon.
Yeah, it'll be pretty funny.
Unfortunately, now, not. I personally would be pretty surprised if they start acknowledging throwing competitions as like a valid strategic idea, the way that Big Brother, frankly, has had no choice to it at this point, just the way that game is formatted. So many people for like a decade now have just recognized what a liability it is to win many of those competitions that they run. And so throwing is a widely accepted practice on Big Brother because it was just unavoidable at a certain point.
That's interesting, actually.
Yeah. All right. So I guess let's get into this second swap now, where you head back over to Malolo. You're back up with Michael. You're also joined by Angela, Kellen, and Desiree now here from the original Navidi. Another rough draw for the Malolos collectively here at this swap. Was it pretty clear relatively quickly that you and Michael would be on the outs here? Did you think you maybe had a shot at Angela voting with you, or any kind of way of sticking around?
So for me, my vote out was a blindside in the sense that it was 4-1. I knew going into Tribal that it was going to be between me and Des. And in my mind, I thought I had flipped Michael and Angela successfully, and they were giving me all the signals that they were willing to vote with me, and that was good play on their part. And so the 4-1 unanimous vote kind of shocked me. And then we can get into the death glare and all that. But, okay, so we swap. And I get to the mat, and I see Michael, and I see the Navidi girls. And so the immediate analysis is that I'm on the minority in every single way possible, which includes original Malolo versus Navidi, the swap Navidi, which is me and Angela, versus Michael, who actually has had time to bond with Dez and Kellen, admittedly. And then two guys and three girls. So it's just not a good scenario for me. But at the same time, my big in with Angela was the fact that I had literally saved her game about, 6 days ago. So I try to, you know, keep pushing on with that narrative. And even before losing the challenge, what Angela and I started doing was beginning with day 10, post the Morgan blindside. What you didn't kind of see was when we got back to camp on day 9, they had just gone blindsided. That is Angela, Dom, and Wendell. Chris was still on Ghost Island. And so we get back. Wendell had a bit of a meltdown, which involved, like, you guys effing lied to my face the whole day. How can you do that? Like, this is hurtful. Like, I'm pissed at you. And then Angela jumped in and said, Wendell, you lied to my face the whole day, so you shut up. And then, you know, shit kind of got heated, and we were sitting there just saying, this is Survivor, and we wanted to stay Malolo strong and finally show that we can do something as well. And the contrast is that the next morning, Dom came to me and extended an olive branch saying, like, that was an awesome move. And yes, like that, I'm pissed and I'm in shock, but playing the scenario back, that was a brilliant blindside and all that. So basically, they acknowledged that we were now in the upper hand. Angela, it was pretty clear to all of us that she had a shell. So for instance, she wouldn't really talk in depth about her time in the army or about her family. And she was kind of a quote-unquote cold person, let's say. So beginning on day 10, it was me and Libby Shaw to work the Chris and Angela angle, and for Laurel and Donathan to work the Dom and Wendell angle. And so I ended up having a lot more conversations with those two. So I talked to Chris about, you know, New York City, about fitness, about all that. And to Angela about my background and my respect for the veterans and all that. So throughout, between day 10 and day 15 even, we got somewhat closer. And then day 15 is when she had this big moment when she started opening up really about everything, about her past to us and Malolo. And I remember pulling her aside and we went on a walk together, just us two, on day 15. And I told her at the Malolo well, so it's pretty clear that, you know, I'm on the bottom now and you're now back with your Nvidia majority. But my pitch was that she obviously was a player of loyalty, knowing her army background. And I was the same kind of person as well. And I had told her at the point about my background of how my grandparents, all four of them, were survivors of the Korean War. And in a couple of those cases, the U.S. Army literally helped save their village and took them to a shelter. So I owe literally my existence to the U.S. Army. And so for me, and this is like really who I am, I will always have a level of respect for veterans that is just beyond my respect for any other type, any other group of people. And she knew that of me. And so I, you know, reemphasized that aspect. And I told her, if you help me get to the merge and survive this phase of the game, I will never write your name down until I vote for you at final travel. And that was my pitch. And, you know, she seemed to receive it pretty well. And so I thought, you know, we are working together. And Michael and I went on some talks as well. So in my head, it was still a plausible scenario that they would side with me. And I will point out that on Twitter, during the live episode, they had a poll. If you or Angela, would you side with James or Kellen? And I believe America voted for me 70-30. So I got to say that. America voted with me.
There you go. But, the game is flawed, James. America needs a vote.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of like my approach to that second swap. But at the end of the day, I think the way I look at it is, A, I was too confident. Well, I was too held up in the rational side of Survivor. So for instance, in my head, my pitch makes sense. I saved your life in the game. I'm loyal to you. If you help save me, I'm going to help you win. If you're a rational player, you probably take that offer. If I'm Michael, I'm back with my Malolo bro, and I want to somehow get us to the majority at the merge. So it makes rational sense to work with James. But what I didn't realize is that for Angela, it was that she was an irrational player. For Michael, it was that he was fully in survival mode, and he was panicking because after having gone through hell on Malolo 2.0, he was back on the same beach, back in the minority, back in the bottom, and he just hated it. He would have done anything to save his own game, that tribal. And I didn't really think through that, those irrational forces, right? And this is where I'm so much like Yul Kwon, is that Yul had this really, I think, insightful quote about himself that I so agree with. Yul said in Cook Islands, I hate the irrational and the emotional because I'm a rational player. And that is so like me. I was playing with Kellen, who was excelling at the emotional game, along with two players who were at a point in time when they were just irrationally playing Survivor to survive. And that's what I didn't fully process. And that's what blinded me to the real threat that I was going to be sent home in a 4-1 vote.
Did you feel like there was anything in retrospect you could have done or wish you had done differently? Or was everything just kind of stacked against you after those buffs got pulled out?
Well, I could have, you know, gone to your new year and just had a free pass to the merge.
Sure, but once you with this with this group.
Yeah, so on Malolo, I think one obvious thing is my pitch to Angela was mainly about, besides the my story about my grandparents, it was mainly a strategic one. I tried to let her see what benefits I would bring to her game if I had saved her. Whereas you do see Kellen focusing on the, I'm your family. I didn't backstab you. I still got your back, emotional plea. And that ended up winning out, right? And so I definitely could have emphasized on, it would have been tough for me to do because I would have felt bad, but emphasize that, look, they told you they would be with you, and then they tried to vote you out of the game. If it were not for me, you would not be here. They're not your family anymore. I'm your family. We are your family, so come with us. Would have been probably a better pitch knowing the kind of person that Angela actually turned out to be. And then for Michael, I think, you know, I couldn't control what he went through on Malolo. And so if, for instance, I had somebody like Laurel there or Libby or Donathan instead of Michael, I think it would have been a sure bet that we would be working together. But, you know, I hadn't seen his face in 9 days at that point. So I don't blame him for prioritizing survival over the, you know, rational choice. And then the funny thing is they ended up all going to the merge because – not because the curse is broken, but because Dom throws a challenge, which is, you know, a nice twist of fate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess, what is the official record? What's the inside scoop on that glare on your way out?
So, yeah, that was directed towards Michael. So as soon as I knew that it was not, you know, 2-3, but rather 4-1, I kind of blacked out. And I think a lot of players will tell you this, that, you know, once your name starts coming up at Tribal Council, you just black out. And so I remember hearing my name once. I expected that from Desiree. And then twice, I kind of expected that from Kellen. And then three times, and then you see the head twist. And then Jeff, you know, just goes, six person photo out of Survivor, go silent, James. And yeah, that glare was towards Michael. The edit made it seem like it was towards Angela because the main narrative story there was Herbie chill towards me. Plus, they wanted to protect the golden boy and Michael. But no, I glared at him, and he looked back at me and with kind of a pout and just shrugged. And, you know, and then I kind of processed everything. Jeff claims that in kind of those 2 seconds, he saw in my eyes the shock, the grief, the rage, and then the acceptance and all that, you know, maybe. But, I, you know, once I stood up and walked towards him, it was overwhelmingly, I had already, you know, put that aside, and I wanted to leave with a genuine farewell to my tribe. And when I said good blindside, I wish you the best of luck, I truly meant it. And so, yeah, that was a fun moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would have been the kind of cutoff point, I guess, between going out? It's obviously not going to be great going out early or pre-merge before the family visit or whatever, but you're still, it seems to me, obviously pretty happy with having been on Survivor, even if it didn't go as well as it conceivably could have. But you said earlier that the kind of Jacob Derwin experience probably would not have felt the same way. A reasonable question to ask what the cutoff point there kind of would have been? Like, was it a big deal just making it to the swap and not literally being like the first person off your tribe? Or is it just a total case by case basis, and there would have been other timelines where you could have made it to final six and felt like it wasn't worth it?
Oh, that's a good question. My gut reaction is that I'm able to look back with a positive light. Because A, I've now had a year to process, but B, during my 17 days on Survivor, I was able to just go through things that I had never expected and to grow as a person and to fight adversity. Now, that is a function, it's a direct function of the amount of time I'm out there. So in terms of personal growth and fighting adversity and grit, more time means better. At the same time, for me, my short arc included both a low light and a high light. And I think that allows me to self-justify, yeah, I had a good run. I was, you know, I had a failure. I overcame it. I had a good blind side. I think that allows me to kind of look back fondly as well. I think the main thing about the Jacob Durbin scenario is that, first of all, Survivor means a lot more to him than me, but it's that he played the game hard, but it never was shown in a lens of merit, right? He never really was portrayed as a capable player, which that's what would have hurt me, as I think, if I had been in that position. For me, CBS literally gave me full credit, well, me and Libby credit, for the Morgan blindside. And having, man, that I will never forget that night when it aired and I got all the reaction. So at like literally by the end of week two, episode three, I knew that I had gone through this tumultuous, you know, arc. And I was also portrayed as one of those, you know, like last standing Mololos who are able to fight. And so to America, people like Brendan, Stephanie Johnson, and me were shown as people that they were supposed to root for. And that was an amazing experience as well, like having America on my side. And to this day, having people come to me and say that we were rooting for you, that we loved watching you on screen instead of go to hell, we hated you, is, I think, what allows me to just be so appreciative of the whole experience. I will say that, putting that all aside, the sheer fact that you are a Survivor castaway, let's say even for the first boot, even for the Gonzalez's and, you know, the Francescas, just being a Survivor castaway and being a part of this amazing franchise and family is a source of pride. But not having been that hero of the week or not having been that strategic mastermind probably would have been tough to swallow. But yeah, I mean, the reasons that I just laid out, I think that's why I'm able to look beyond the 15th place outcome and truly take in Survivor for the amazing growth that it gave me.
What if you are able to kind of remove your own experience being a part of it from the equation? What did you think of how your season ended up like as a TV product and the way that it ended up playing out?
Yeah, so the funny thing is throughout the off season leading up to our premiere, we kept hearing from production that this was going to be an all time great season. We're talking top five, China, Kageyan level hype. And so we were cautiously optimistic. I mean, they definitely know what they're talking about. So I knew personally that it was going to be a fire pre-merge. So I think now that the season's over, I think the consensus is that we are a mid-tier season in like the 15 to 20-ish placement. And, you know, whatever the fans say, it is true in that case. And I do agree that the post-merge was a little bit weak. I'm biased, right? Like, I'm a part of the Ghost Island family. And so I want my season to be received well and for it to be hyped up and stuff. And people will probably remember our season for the strong pre-merge that gave way to a pretty boring post-merge, then a historic finale. They'll probably remember us for the tie vote, obviously, for the creative twist that defined our season, Ghost Island, that may even be repeated again. There may be a Ghost Island 2. They'll remember us for, I don't know, like for being the Don and Wendell show, Laurel not pulling the trigger, Chelsea the Purple Queen, mm-hmm. and I'm biased, but maybe one of the greatest newbie pre-merge groups ever.
No question on that last front, by the way. I think the opinions seem to be all over the map, frankly, about Ghost Island, but I have not heard many people saying anything other than the whole pre-merge group was fantastic.
Yep, and it's humbling to hear always, you know, and we as a group of seven, we always appreciate hearing that. So maybe there is and this is our pitch, is that maybe there is a pre-merge season in the books. And so if that happens, I want, you know, several from this group to go back on.
Yeah, I've been thinking about what may be coming down the line as far as like returnee seasons go. And as exciting as like a Legends or an all winter season would be to me, I would be concerned that that would be them signaling this is almost over now. I'm a big advocate. I think I'm going to start being a bigger advocate for Second Chance 2, I think would be really well timed pretty soon. And I frankly think any of the seven of you guys would make a ton of sense being on that ballot if it's another ballot situation or if you guys are just put out there on the cast. I think you, not just you in particular, but certainly you among this whole group would be a lot of fun to have back out there for sure.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is, you know, now that we've had some time to process post the season, post the finale, I think for me, the way I'm approaching this is I got some really good advice from alumni about how to adjust back to the real world in a healthy way. And for instance, like people like Fishback, Yule, Aubrey, well, we've had conversations. And the healthy way is to live your life and stay busy and stay occupied. And so for me, that's definitely going to be the case because school will keep me very busy the next 4 years. But at the same time, you know, it's unhealthy to always hope every day, wake up and think, am I going to get the call today to go back? But rather keep it in the back of your mind and just, you know, appreciate Survivor, be proud of it. And if the call comes one day, pick it up and say, I'd love to go back. But don't make that a like this forefront priority for you. Right. And so I'm trying to, you know, once school starts, I'm going to go all in on school, like enjoying my life back on campus and cheering on the new cast for 37 and 38 and the Amazing Race 31. And, you know, if the call comes, it'll come. But I'm also prepared to say, you know, like if the call never comes, it was a good run. And I am so grateful that I'm a part of this family now, you know.
We always like to ask what that decompression period is like, because we think that's a massively overlooked part of the whole experience for people. But it sounds like for you, it was relatively simple, and you've come to that with a good attitude about it.
So the decompression from the game and the season, I think, are two different experiences. The decompression from the game for me was I got back from Australia, took another week off to adjust, and then went back to work. And let me tell you, my first day back at work, I was useless as a consultant. Legitimately, I was confused as to how to send emails. So
you forgot how to type.
Literally, yes. I forgot my corporate phone's passcode, so I had to go to Apple to open it up again. So I did that, and I adjusted back to my busy corporate world. And so my job did a pretty good job keeping me busy, obviously. And so I did that. I made sure that I was staying in regular touch with my friends from my cast and the Survivor alumni. Being a New Yorker, it was great because people like Andrea, who interviewed us actually for Press Day, and then like Eliza and Courtney Yates, who are part of the New York City group, welcomed us with open arms. And so that was great because I feel like I was able to work hard during the week and maybe like once or twice a month go to a Ghost Island reunion and get some Korean barbecue and cocktails, or go get some coffee with the New York City alumni group and that kind of stuff. So I did that. But once, you know, the new year hit, and once we were getting communication from CBS, like it's almost time, it's your season now. It got really exciting, and then we got announced. That day was January 31st, I think. And my, you know, work email started blowing up. I get texts from friends who saw the announcement. My company dining hall, I think, had coconut salad that day, which was fitting. But yeah, so then we went through that. The actual season for me was a whirlwind because I was still at work, and so I was not able to just decompress and enjoy it fully. I had a premiere party in Manhattan that I rented out a bar, and Jacob and Des were also there and invited about 50 of my friends, and we had a blast watching it together. But for some weeks, even during my season, like I was just busy at work. I was in the office. And so I came home and at 2 a.m. after finishing work, logged on to CBS All Access and watched it online alone in my hotel room. And then I got voted out, did my exit press, and then I quit my job about a week before the finale. And so I was able to fly off to LA as a free man and enjoy all that LA had to offer. So I think now flying home from LA was, I think, the symbolic end for a lot of us, that your turn's over. It's now on to the off season, and then it's on to season 37. And when I first got home, it was a little bit depressing, but I think, you know, time always heals wounds. And so I'm now able to, you know, accept the fact that we're now alumni, kind of washed up, and it's now time for the new Davids and Goliaths.
Are you excited to be back to being a regular viewer, or do you think you're going to miss the spotlight, or where are you on that?
To be perfectly honest, I think I'll miss some parts of the experience of, you know, being on the season. So, yeah, like being the talk of the town online, people will probably recognize me far less often now that the new season is coming up. Or just, you know, my friends reacting to every episode every week and texting me like what the hell happened, or a great job, like that stuff will be, I'll miss that, honestly. But it's also a big burden to relieve myself of, as especially like school starting up again and classes and stuff. So I think I will appreciate the chance to go back to being a fan and maybe live tweeting some episodes here and there and getting to know the new cast.
What are some good untold stories from the whole experience that you feel the world needs to know? Because we got the dog story from Dom, and here, that set the bar pretty high, but I'm confident that you can clear it.
Oh, I'm not confident that I can clear that bar. Dom is, I'm telling you, one of the greatest storytellers in Survivor history. And I heard that story live on the VD Beach. We were laughing our asses off. It was so funny. Like,
I think we got kind of the watered down version of the story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's right that, like, you need some cocktails. Or, I mean, in our case, we were just delirious from starvation and exhaustion. Oh, man, but he was telling us a story. It was, like, it's, like, 20 minutes long, and it was so funny, yeah.
Tell us one of Dom's stories that he was too afraid to tell us.
I think, no, that's, like, the signature. You got the signature Dom Abati course there. I don't have a colorful history like that, nor do I have a father-in-law yet. But I don't know. Like, we've had some fun reunions postseason, and I've been a part of most of it because I was lucky enough to have a flexible work schedule that gave me weekends off, and I live in New York City, which was kind of a hub. So, you know, about 2 weeks after coming back home, we got together in Koreatown. So it's me, Dominic, Jacob, Des, Wendell. Andrea Belke came to say hi for a little bit. And I had hyped up Korean barbecue so much on the island that we even decided on the VD that we were going to just go get Korean barbecue as a reunion post-game. So we made it happen. Got that. Went to a rooftop bar on top of Fifth Avenue with a view of the Empire State Building. And Dom insisted that we all get Long Islands because he's from Long Island. And you know how those cocktails go. So we got pretty drunk and had a really good time. And then we've had reunions in Orlando visiting Morgan at SeaWorld and going fishing with Sebastian. We've had one trip to San Diego where we went sailing on the bay with Bradley being the captain. And it's just looking back, these reunions also, right, like it's a lot of us bringing parts of ourselves to the group. So, for instance, you know, Bradley's ability to sail, Morgan's job, Sebastian's job, you know, like my love for Korean barbecue, I guess, like that kind of stuff. And it is almost shocking to me how many friends, for instance, that I made throughout the season. I went out there, yes, thinking that I wanted to leave the game on good terms with everybody, and that is the case. But I didn't expect to make this many lifelong friends and people that I like actually like admire. For instance, you know, like having been roommates with Brendan throughout Australia, like that's the kind of guy that I want to like model myself after once I have a family, you know, like that kind of stuff. And same with Dom, like the two dads of the season are just great role models for me to look up to as like just husbands and fathers, you know, like, and I wouldn't expect a reality TV show to give me those role models. Or to just meet people from all over America. Like, I would never have met Jonathan Hurley ever if it were not for Survivor. Same with people like Angela or Morgan, you know? And now they consider me a friend and I consider them a friend. And so it's just that human part of Survivor. Yes, it's not central to the game at all. It's more like a positive byproduct, but it's something that I really, really love. And it's something that I've gained from being on Survivor. as well as like all the alumni as well that I've been able to get in touch with and hang out with. So, yeah.
I don't know if that counts as a story, but it's very wholesome, and it's good to hear that, and it's a nice summary of the whole Survivor experience.
Yeah, we're a good cast, and I'm biased, definitely, but you know, I would compare us to about like 33, where a lot of people just genuinely liked just a lot of the characters on screen, you know, Brett, Chris, Adam, and Jay, like Figgy, that kind of stuff, you know? So it's like a wholesome cast.
Yeah. One thing I always like to ask the survivors that we get to interview, what are your thoughts on Jeff Probst?
Yeah, so funny enough, I mean, when my friends from real life ask me, what is he like? It's a really common question. I think the most common what is blank likes have been what is Chris Noble like and what is Jeff Probst like?
I think that's fair. So, that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So Jeff Probst, what you see on TV is what you actually get in person. So I first came face-to-face with him as a part of casting finals week, right? So we have an interview. And just to walk into the hotel room and see him alongside, you know, Matt Van Wagenen and all the producers – and I was like starstruck, right? And I think he has this kind of charisma that he probably has innately, but also he has developed over his 18-year career. He has this kind of aura that if he speaks, you just listen. Like if he tells you something, you listen. And he has the ability to kind of like capture the room, or if it's on set, he has the ability to capture the space that he's in, right? And to take the spotlight and to lead something. I think that's one ability that I think has made him probably the greatest reality show host ever. He also, I think it's pretty obvious to us at this point that he truly loves Survivor. And I mean, that does define him as a person. And he believes that that's, you know, his baby and that's his show and it's his responsibility to do the best for Survivor. Now, this may come in the form of, you know, the cast that he, you know, plays a big role in casting or the new twists or like whatever that may be. I think he does live and breathe Survivor. I was very impressed by him, to be honest. And between me and him, we have kind of a history because of the whole James is a robot controversy. But
the squiggle?
That squiggle was one thing, and also like the I would liken James to a machine. Like you remember that from pregame?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He called me a robot, and so to kind of go into that briefly, as a part of my final interview with Jeff, you know, I walked into the room ready to pitch myself as a cast member, and my mistake was I thought my resume was what made me interesting, because you know like. I do think that the things that I've gone through in the past, my background combined with my job as a white collar professional and a Harvard track captain and all that was what they were looking for in a cast member. And so I just started like rattling off my resume. And during my spiel, Jeff just goes, stop. And then I obviously stop because Jeff Probst is telling you to stop. And he goes, you know what I think? I think you're a robot. I think you are super smart, you're obviously super athletic, you don't have emotions. And I'm just like, what, you know? I'm kind of taken aback. And he goes on to say stuff like, if I wanted to have a beer with a friend after a long day of work, I would never call you, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I think the backstory there is he has seen my bio and he already knew that I had a squiggle IQ, whatever that is. And so in his brain, he had kind of put me aside as the game bot of the season, the super analytical player. And then I fit his image because I was just rallying off my you know, job, my internships and stuff, and my GPA and stuff. And so he was like, yeah, this guy's just insufferable. So he gave me a hard time. And he told me to go watch Tony Robbins. And my question was, who the hell is that? Because I literally didn't know who Tony Robbins was. And so he told me he's like this big self-help person like that has lectures and YouTube videos. And he said, go like look him up.
Probst being a Tony Robbins fan is the funniest thing in the world.
Yeah, Probst is a Tony Robbins fan. So and Seth said, okay, so I'll do that. And then he just goes, stop wasting my time. Get out of here. So in my mind, that was the worst interview ever. Like my shot at Survivor was over. I was really shaken and I left the room. And I went downstairs and literally Googled Tony Robbins and started watching some videos of his. And while doing that, he sent Cassing down to check on me because he then realized like just how tough he was on me. And apparently he thought I was older than 23, which I was at that point in time. And so Cassing comes down and she's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, watching Tony Robbins because he told me to. And so Cassing calls Jeff and tells him. And Jeff apparently said, I love that. He's actually doing it. He's following through. And so I was able to get his good graces and actually make the cast. And I promised him before flying out that I would show him that through Tony Robbins, I was able to also master the social game of Survivor. And post-game, he told me over a beer, we had a beer, and he told me that, yes, I proved to him that I wasn't actually a game bot. And he was impressed by how genuine I was as a human being and a player. And so I appreciate that, you know. So I guess I was able to dispel that robot impression of me.
Yeah, the story completely checks out on Jeff being a Tony Robbins fan. But are you now? What's the official scoop on Tony Robbins now that you've studied it extensively?
No, I am not his fan. I just...
Well, thank God.
I felt bad as soon as I said it the first time. I was like, oh my God, if he's a big Tony Robbins guy too, I just really put my foot in my mouth.
Nope. I mean, I just wanted to know who he was, and I looked him up on YouTube. I probably listened to about 2-3 hours before my final interview, just to make sure that I like knew what Tony Robbins' like message is, and you know, like his guidebook to like social strategy, like, oh, you know, whatever. So I did my homework, but after I got cast, no Tony Robbins.
Hey,
no.
Dom, quick question for you. You're stranded on a desert island. Who would you rather be there with, Tony Robbins or Malcolm Gladwell?
Malcolm Gladwell at least is entertaining. Tony Robbins is just in your face obnoxious. But James, to return to something that you've mentioned time and time again, not just here, but in your other interviews and so on, you come back to your Harvard track and field days a lot, and you get the sense that being an athlete, it isn't just something you do because why not, or it's something you do because that's what you're expected to do. It is actually something that you really care about and are heavily invested in. So can you take us through that quickly?
Yeah, I think one regret I have is that I never, you know, on air, I never once mentioned Harvard. I did have a fake identity out there. And so Harvard track and field was never actually mentioned, I think, on Survivor. And so it's kind of a shame because it is a big part of my past. And so
yeah, if you've been to Harvard, you're legally obliged to mention it at least once a day.
Did your Chiron say anything about Harvard?
It said a business analyst.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, even management consultant, I said that, and CVS said that's too complicated. So what about business analyst? And I was fine with that. But the story about Harvard track is that so I started track only when I first got to Phillips Andover. So my sophomore year, I started indoor track and outdoor track, but I did love running my whole life. It's just that in South Korea, there just simply is no concept of sports. No, you're either an athlete or a student. That's it. So, you know, I knew that I loved sprinting, and I got the opportunity to really join a team for the first time and be an athlete my sophomore year. I think I started off in like the long sprints, so that 300-ish distance, and won my first letter, and I loved it. Loved being part of a team. And I ended up being a captain for indoor and outdoor track my senior year. The problem is I wasn't fast enough at all to become a Division I sprinter. So I got recruited. I got recruiting emails from a couple of Division III schools, but once I got into Harvard, I knew that I wanted to walk on to the team, and so I sent the coach an email, and that's Coach Manjakati. So he told me to come try out. So I arrived on campus for orientation. I went to the track alone to practice, you know, every afternoon for about 2 weeks before tryouts. And I didn't know that at the time, but apparently he sat in the office watching me practice. And he apparently thought, whoever this guy is, he's probably going to try out. He's coming here every single day to practice. Like, I like that mindset at least, right? So I tried out. And fortunately for me, I ran my all-time best times ever at tryouts. And it was a time that barely made his mental cutoff of, okay, I want to give this guy a shot in Harvard men's sprints. So I was a walk-on sprinter. And in my 4 years as part of the team, I think we went through a lot of growth as a team in terms of like doing well at Ivies and winning titles, but also as a men's sprints group, we grew from about 7 guys to 22 as an event group. And I will maintain that it's the single best choice that I made in my college career was to try for Harvard track. I ended up having the honor of being elected captain my senior year. It really defined who I was as a person on campus. And I, to this day, you know, will try to sprint often, do some track workouts. I love that aspect of just you run as hard as you can against the clock. That's it. It's pure, you know. And so I'm the kind of guy, you probably, if you follow me on Instagram, one of my highlights from my entire month-long Euro trip was getting to sprint in the Pan-Hellenic Stadium where the original Olympics were held. And to sprint on that legendary track for me was a dream come true. And I follow, you know, like USA track and field religiously. I can like rattle off all these athletes' names and stuff. So that athlete mindset was still fresh in my mind on Survivor because I played about a year removed from my time as an athlete. And so part of my job, I thought was to represent our program well. That didn't go too well, but at least I was able to talk about, you know, how much being an athlete has formed my values, which led me to just be really hard on myself after the dive fail. And, you know, my guys texted me that night and said, dude, bro, you may be fast on land, but you're useless in the water. And I'm like, yep, I'll take that. You know, that's kind of true.
Fair enough. Yeah.
When you talk about representing your program, it's not just winning whatever you're taking part in. It's also the attitude that you bring to bear on that and the dedication and the practice and so on. And it sounds like on all those fronts, there's really nothing that they could fault you for.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they've graciously told me postseason that, yes, despite my outcome and all that, they feel like, you know, I was a good representative to go on Survivor and to be a Harvard track athlete to just, you know, represent them on national TV. And the funny thing is Coach Mangiacotti, this person's a pretty big figure in my story because he's been a fan since Borneo. He's that kind of super fan like Brendan and Stephanie Johnson. To the point where he would literally sometimes give us pep talks. I remember before I joined the Survivor casting process, he once gave us a pep talk about Worlds Apart and about how we were training like white collar soft blanks and we had to train like blue collars, and that he was watching a TV show about that battle and we needed that blue collar rough mentality, that we need to get tougher. I remember thinking that was really interesting, but that was exactly during the Worlds Apart season, and he got that pep talk idea from Survivor. And so once I started casting, I told Coach Mange, once I got cast in, he revealed to me that he was a lifelong fan. And so, you know, he wished me good luck, and I was able to have him at the finale week as one of my guests. And it was, to him, apparently a dream come true. And I'm very glad that one of his athletes going on Survivor, like somebody that he trusted to give a spot on Harvard track to, I wouldn't become a Harvard track athlete or a captain if it were not for his trust in me. And so for me to repay that debt in the form of an unforgettable Survivor finale week experience was amazing. So, yeah.
Yeah. I can't believe we got this whole way through and I only lectured you about not watching The Genius twice. That I certainly would have bet the over on that number. But James, thank you so much for giving us so much time. We got through so much today and you were fantastic and so insightful. We really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. And I assume you guys will keep on doing this for the upcoming seasons. And so keep at it. Keep up the good work. And I'd love to come back as a guest if you ever need one.
Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely.
And have a great off season.
Yeah. Hey, is there anything you would like to plug? I know you're on Twitter and you just mentioned the Instagram. Where can people be finding you?
So my Instagram is at James Lim Sees, S-E-E-S, and my Twitter is James Lim Says. So put together, the handles make more sense. And I mean, you know, I don't have anything big coming up. You know, I'm just going to start school, be busy, but I'll probably try to stay involved in the Survivor community for sure. So I'll be a part of the Boston crew now, going to be up there with Jeremy, Michelle, Rodney, et cetera. And I'll try to make it to the Know-It-Alls, for instance. I'll try to do that October 3rd, I believe. And you know, you guys will probably be there as well. So it would be a nice reunion.
Yeah.
And you know, if I do anything, I'll probably share with you guys through Instagram and Twitter. So keep an eye out there.
Awesome. Dom, anything else that you wanted to get to?
I was just going to ask about any other James Lim-themed social media handles we should be following.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you once again, James. Thanks to everyone listening who made it this far. Such a good time. I'm sure we'll be back relatively soon with more off-season content. And then I'm sure it's going to be no time before Survivor 37 is knocking on the door. So I guess subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. I'm sure there are going to be plenty of people hearing this interview and who haven't really heard of us before, but hey, if you made it this far, I would imagine you would like most of our other stuff. At least I hope so. Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. You can email the show domandcolin@gmail.com. And if you're interested, we do weekly bonus episodes going through old seasons of CBS reality. Right now, we're in the middle of Heroes versus Villains. You can find all of that new episodes every Saturday over at patreon.com/domandcolin. I think that is going to do it. We'll get you guys out of here. Thank you once again for making it this far. Take care, everybody.